my agenda in order. And one. That's all those ballot initiatives. Where were you the other day? You weren't in San Luis. Where were you? We were looking for you. Thursday.
Friday.
You didn't
show. Good evening. If I could have my council up here, we are on camera and ready to go. All right. If I could ask everyone to please settle down. We will bring to order the council meeting of April 13th, 2009. Let the record show that all council members are present, and we'll begin our meeting with a moment of silence. Thank you. All right. For our business this evening and to lead us in the pledge, we have Christopher Logan from Gourmet Grub.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, Mr. Gardner, Logan, tell us all about Gourmet Grub, if some of us didn't already know.
All right, well, I'm Christopher Logan. Me and my mom opened Gourmet Grub about 4 years ago. We decided to try to open a restaurant after growing up here that offered homemade food, and we use all natural ingredients. We use free-range chicken, free-range eggs, nitrate-free bacon, and natural vintage beef. All of our distributors that we get our beef and vegetables from are certified organic. We make our own soups, pastas, salads, pretty much everything we make from scratch. We serve soup that won the chowder competition for a judge's choice. We do a free-range, all of our pizza dough is freshly made. Everything we make is from scratch. My sister makes all of our desserts. We do creamed pies, homemade cheesecake, everything of that nature. I've never watched one of these before, so this is new to me. We'd like to invite everybody to come down and try our restaurant. We're located right by the movie theater. We try to get out as fast as we can for people that want to come and watch the movies. We recommend showing up before 6:30, though. We are pretty fast, but we're not that fast. Everything is, again, from scratch, so it does take a little while. That's pretty much all we kind of have. We're also doing happy hour now, Tuesday through Saturday.
Singing of the Fleet starts at noon. It's a lovely ceremony. If you haven't seen it, come on down to the T Pier, and there's a ceremony first, and then they bless all the boats in the fleet. So it's really a nice thing, and we'll hope for good weather for that. Other announcements. This is the first real full council meeting we've had since Rick and I got back from Washington. We had a very full week talking to a lot of people all around the Capitol. It's a very exciting time to be there. As I'm sure you can imagine, there were a lot of people there looking for money, and we were too. But it was a very busy, busy week. We talked to all of our representatives, the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund, which the group that we went down there with, CMANC, has been trying to get recognition for years. We have finally broken through the wall in Congress, and Senator Boxer has even promised to have a hearing on the issue. So that what happens is the tax that is collected on all the goods that come through our harbors will actually be used for its intended purposes, which is to maintain our harbors, dredging and other issues that we need doing. So we finally broke through that wall. We're really excited about that. And Rick and I also did a lot of informing people about our fishing programs that we're working on with the Nature Conservancy and how progressive Morro Bay is being in finding ways to be environmentally sensitive and still economically viable for our fishing fleets. So there was a lot of respect and interest in that, and we are actually being looked at as the forerunners in some of these experimental programs, which is something we can be very proud of. So it was a good trip. It was a hard trip, but it was, I think, one of the most successful that we've had. And we certainly have our main dredging funds. We're hoping to get the Back Bay dredged as well, so that's still up in the air. Maybe next meeting we'll be able to say we got that too. So I think that's it on my announcements. Betty, anything?
Yes, I attended two meetings last week. One was the Water Resources Advisory Committee. We had our regular meeting with regular items. Still trying to put pressure on Monterey County to help with the screening of the boats in the freshwater lakes. But more importantly, we had a special meeting last Saturday to talk about the Los Osos sewer project in terms of its water and wastewater and seawater intrusion. And the RAC will make recommendations to the Board of Supervisors. The second meeting was I had the opportunity to go to the Greenville Quarterly meeting, and there is a newsletter that's out at the Public Services desk if anyone's interested in the latest information that's coming through there.
Noah.
Yeah, just a brief announcement. I got a bit of a shock this morning, some flashbacks. I got my sample ballot in the mail for the May 19th election, which there are quite a few initiatives for the state, and I just wanted to remind people that if you do need information about getting registered to vote, you can call the county clerk recorder at 781-5080. And there's still time to get registered to vote, and I hope you would. Also, just briefly, wanted to invite you all out to a quick announcement regarding the Water Festival, which is an event that we're organizing. The city of Morro Bay is involved with and a consortium of other groups around the county. We're going to be doing a big festival at the Morro Rock, on the south side of the Rock, actually, on June 20th. Music, food, and all sorts of family-friendly events celebrating the watershed, and it's going to actually fall on International Surfing Day. We're expecting about 2,000 people to come through town for that and attend. So it's going to be free, and I'll be bringing much more information to the community as we finish the organizing for the event.
Great. Got it.
Good evening. Thank you. I'd like to start off by saying what a great time I had on the 3rd at the Tip a Cup dinner. It was wonderful. Thank you to Chief Drohan and all the police officers who were there serving. It was a lot of fun. I last Friday attended a meeting in San Luis that was sponsored by Assemblyman Sam Blakesley. It was a small business jobs forum. It was for San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County businesses, Chamber of Commerce's. Peter Candela was there. I see him here this evening. There were chamber representatives there, and council representation from as far away as Lompoc, Santa Maria, Paso Robles. It was a great opportunity to listen to other communities and what they're going through with their local businesses, the struggles they're having, and realize that, as we all know, we're not alone in where we're at in Morro Bay. I would encourage any of you who have something you want to say, concerns, suggestions, ideas, anything related to the economic concerns in retail, and whether it's fishing industry, any business right now, that you email your assemblyman. He is going to have a follow-up workshop. These communities are trying to work together. He does care, and it was a really good forum. It was about 2.5 hours long, and his web.
All right, our staff reports our police and fire tonight. Which of you would like to start?
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm representing Chief Pond tonight. Since last council meeting on March 23rd, the fire department responded to 95 incidents, mostly medical, with 33 requiring paramedic care. 14 of these calls were either simultaneous or back-to-back. Fire personnel also responded to 8 mutual aid calls, including a trench rescue at California Men's Colony, a cliff rescue in Shell Beach, and a fire investigation in Atascadero. Two structure fires in Los Osos, a vehicle fire off Highway 41, a traffic accident on Highway 41, and an ALS emergency near our city limits. Also, currently, our personnel are working with the architect on Phase 2, trying to finalize up those plans, and we're getting real excited about that. Just a reminder, everyone has received on April 1st their notice to abate their weeds and debris from their properties. Please follow the guidelines on the form, and we're asking our citizens to bait their properties between May 15th and June 15th. Since the marine weather that we get, we still have green grasses still, and we want to make sure they don't have to cut them twice. If there's any questions about the weed abatement, please come on down and or call the fire station. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm sure everyone is aware of the homicide that we had last week. Our investigators are still very hard at work, along with the District Attorney's Office and the Sheriff's Department, investigating this. I have nothing new to report that I can share at this point, other than what you've seen in the media and in the press releases. However, I do want to take a moment to mention the great job that our employees did, from not only the initial calls of service to the current investigation. Dispatcher Smith was the only dispatcher on duty when the calls came in, and she was inundated with over 20 911 simultaneous calls of shots fired, people down. She had to dispatch officers, fire, requested mutual aid, making notifications. And, of course, during all this time, every media company in the world calls and wants to know what's going on. And they have to be politely told that we're in the middle of this, and she did a great job with that. She was by herself and did an excellent job. Officer Gene Stewart was the first officer on the scene and was probably confronted with his worst nightmare. He came across gunshot victims and suspects still fighting, not knowing who the good guys were and who the bad guys were, not knowing if other armed suspects were still on the scene that were going to shoot him, and, of course, the deceased body. Officer Stewart kept a cool head, held everyone, obviously, at gunpoint until additional help arrived. And then these officers had to search the residence for additional suspects, which could be a potential active shooter situation, not knowing what's going on inside the house. Sergeant Millard arrived and set up a command post and began directing operations. Commander Olivas responded from home, assisted with the command. I responded from home, and when I arrived, I found a very organized command post set up, and, of course, everyone trying to plan operations with minimal staffing at that point. Several sheriff's deputies arrived to assist us, along with the sheriff's crime scene personnel, district attorney's office investigators, so we got a lot of help, which we're very thankful for. And then during all this, we had some other calls for service that we didn't have anybody to send to, so it was about an hour before we could free up some resources to address some of these other calls. One was a priority that had to wait for a while. Corporal Gomes is the lead investigator and is working with the lead district attorney's office investigator as we speak, and still trying to put this case together. It's like a, as I stated with the media, it's like a big puzzle that we're trying to put all the pieces together. So I'm really proud of our personnel, how professional they handled themselves, especially during this tragic event. And I'm really also thankful for all the police volunteers that showed up during the middle of the night being called out. They helped secure the crime scene in a perimeter all night long and all the next day up until about 6, 7 o'clock when the crime scene was finally freed up. Other than that, in addition to this, we've been really busy with lots of calls for service this past week. We had a lot of DUI arrests, more thefts of unlocked vehicles, and I keep saying this every council meeting. Members of the community, please lock your vehicles. Several disturbance calls, traffic collisions, etc. It's like Councilwoman Borchard said, we had a very successful Tipicop dinner. I heard we raised over $6,000 for Special Olympics. It's one of the biggest events in the best attendance we've had so far.
That's great.
That's all I have.
I just want to say, too, I mean, fortunately, we don't have incidents like this often in Morro Bay, and I hope we don't see one again for many, many years. But I want to say that our police staff and the volunteers did such an excellent job covering this situation, and I want to applaud all of you.
These projects, they have all been submitted to our legislators. A letter went out to Lois Capps, and I believe that we also submitted these to Barbara Boxer.
They were delivered by hand to both senators and Lois Capps.
Very good. So they are out there, and we are doing everything we can to get whatever we can. So I just want you to know that. Thank you.
All right. We have one proclamation on our agenda tonight, and I'd like to pull it off and ask the council to approve A6 so that I can make a presentation of that this evening.
So move.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. Okay, Mary Sponholz, would you please come forward? This is appropriate given what happened this last week, too. This is the National Public Safety Telecommunications Week, and so this is a proclamation. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but public safety dispatchers are the first and most critical contact our citizens have with emergency services. The dispatchers of the Morro Bay Police Department have contributed substantially to the apprehension of criminals, suppression of fires, treatment of patients, and each dispatcher has exhibited compassion, understanding, and professionalism during the performance of their job in the past year. Therefore, be it resolved that the City Council of the City of Morro Bay hereby proclaims the week of April 12th through 18th as National Public Safety Telecommunications Week in honor of the women and men whose diligence and professionalism keep our city and citizens safe. Mary's one of them, and thank you for representing all of your associates in this.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you, Jenny. Well, it was already mentioned briefly, I was hoping to have Dispatcher Smith here. However, she's working a 12-hour shift tonight, and I didn't know if we would be able to get her in and back to work in time. But I did want to recognize her for her outstanding job Wednesday evening. I don't know how she could have done it. If I was in her shoes, I don't know if I would have been able to do the same job as professionally and with the level head on her shoulders. And I talked to her the next day, and she just said, well, it's just about prioritizing. It was she did a great job, so that's all I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Rob, closed session report.
Yes, good evening. Prior to tonight's regular session, council met in closed session to discuss pending litigation and real property transactions. The pending litigation discussed was City of Morro Bay versus Martini. The real property transactions was Whale's Tail, Salt Building, and Harbor Hut. As to all these items, no action was taken that requires reporting under the Brown Act.
Okay. And next is our public comment, and we see a whole bunch of public commenters over there. So please come forward and keep your comments to 3 minutes, please.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. First, let me thank Keith Taylor for trading places with me. We have another engagement this evening, and sometimes my assistant gets a little impatient here. We're here because it's that time of year again. It's time to plant your dahlias. Dahlia Days will be held, just in case anybody out there has possibly forgotten, the dahlia is the Morro Bay City flower. So just wanted to remind you of that. Dahlia Days this year will be held in early August, and we're starting to get ready now. We have some plans about what we're going to do. One of the new things we're adding this year will be awards, as members of the Morro Bay Garden Club are driving around town and looking for the most beautiful yards. Dahlias growing in yards will be giving dahlia awards. So get your flowers going, and we'll be out there watching. Also, this year we have a new theme for our Dahlia Days, and it's celebrating our local heroes. So I have something for you that my assistant's going to help me pass out here.
What's your assistant's name?
This is my granddaughter, Ann Catherine Rachi, who lives in Merced. Okay, you see that police chief right there? Can you take him one of these? And there are his instructions, too. Last year, we didn't hand out instructions, and this year, we're giving instructions. And I notice our fire chief isn't here, but maybe we can trust this gentleman over here to take care of his dahlia for him. And we wouldn't want to forget the Harbor Patrol is one of our local heroes. So here we have one for Rick Albert. See the man over there in the green jacket who's waving at you? So you water those and take very good care of them, and we'll let you know the exact date when it comes up in early August. See you there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks to your assistant.
Oh, say thank you.
The application's back in by Thursday, April 16th, so I have time to process them. But
if I'll take a few late applications if that happens too. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm Jenna Healy of San Luis Obispo. I've been a resident in SLO County for 9 years, and I really love the area. Everybody around here is usually very nice. I'm standing before you today to share a story in hopes that some action can be taken to ensure my situation is not repeated. In January 2005, I had spent already a few years running on the beaches between Cayucas and Morro Bay. I was out running with my golden retriever one afternoon, and I was stopped by a patrolman. I'm the daughter of bird watchers, and I've always been respectful to the snowy plover zone, and I was not in that zone on that day. I entered the beach at Studio Drive in Cayucas that afternoon, which is dog-friendly, and I had run all the way down to Morro Bay, probably a couple of hundred meters above where the snowy plover zone is. And I turned around. I use that as my turnaround point because I know that dogs aren't supposed to be in that zone. And I was chased down by what I now believe is a state patrolman after talking to the previous speaker. I found him very offensive, and he left me feeling pretty violated. He spoke to me as if I was a criminal and asked me to put my hands on the front of his truck. I had never been in trouble before and had no idea I was breaking the law to begin with. He then told me I was being charged with a misdemeanor and a $400 fine. So I appeared before a judge who pretty much laughed at the offense and reduced it to $25, yet I still have a misdemeanor on my record. So this experience, obviously it was 4 years ago and I'm still upset about it. Affected how I view Morro Bay and affected how I've spent money in your town, how much time I spend, and how I talk to people about it. So I have two suggestions. If you can address the issue with whoever's patrolling the beaches so they more appropriately treat people, and also mark the area a little bit better so that if people are running distance, they know where they are and aren't supposed to be. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good evening. Claire Grantham, resident of Morro Bay. I just wanted to, first of all, thank the police. You know, it was pretty scary when I turned on the evening news Wednesday night. I happened to be up and hear that there was a shooting going on right then. Someone was dead, and there were two people. And this was only a half an hour after it. And, of course, I went back and thought about our police department, and I just was thinking back to last year when someone stood up here and mentioned that we're just a sleepy little town, and we don't really need to have a big high-tech police department. I'm not saying we need a high-tech police department, but we need a very strong police department like we have. And I just want to remind all of you that your responsibility is for public safety, and as you go through budget cuts and financial decisions, the police department's not the place to cut. And we need to look at getting our staffing back up to where it once was. We were lucky on Wednesday night. It sounds like we had a trainee on, and we have great backup here in the county, but a bad outcome, a bad situation could have been so much worse. You know, and I'm just really, really grateful for the professionals we have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mayor, Council, staff, and the people at home. My name is Keith Taylor. I'm a resident of Morro Bay. I'm a friend of the Morro Bay Fire Department. I'm here tonight to just call attention to the fence that's next to the Apparatus Bay, or Phase 1. You'll see a banner there, and on that banner, we're lucky enough to have Gary and Gwen, mainly Gwen at Goofy Graphics, did this for us with putting a digital picture on there. I don't understand how they did it, but it is very cool. And the reason that we did it, the friends, is we want everyone to understand that the fire department isn't finished yet, and we're doing phase two. and I want to thank all of you for voting to get the funding. The other thing I'd like to talk about is our yard sale, which was Friends of the Police and Friends of the Fire Department. We only had it on Saturday one day, but we made $840 or whatever it was. So we were all excited about that. And it was
free to join a team. If you're a cancer survivor, come out and walk that first lap. It's all about you as a cancer survivor. Bring your caregiver. Those people are so important and never get the recognition that they deserve. This year we celebrate the symbol through opening ceremonies and caregiver laps. We honor survivors and caregivers during the opening ceremony and the celebration lap. We remember those with the luminary ceremony, including caregivers during the ceremony, and we fight back against this horrible disease. So we invite all of you to come out August 1st at Morro Bay High School and be a part of Relay for Life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable Mayor, esteemed council, my name is Bill Woodson. I'm a resident of Morro Bay. We all know that there is not a problem that cannot be solved if people would simply do as I advise. And I advise that tonight on your agenda, number D2, is the reduced fee incentive for green building and low impact development. And I'm very strongly urge you to endorse staff's recommendation on this, that the City Council offer green building incentives in reimbursing building plan check and inspection fees. I'm very proud the city is getting ready to jump on the energy awareness bandwagon, and I think it's a very appropriate thing to do. The staff's recommendation includes $3,000 for successful completion of National Recognized Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, better known as LEED. And LEED certification provides an independent third-party verification that the project is as green as the technology available today is. And then the second thing that you're going to consider is $2,000 for the California, rather than the national, the California Greenpoint rated project certification, and that is a California program that is a little step down and a good place to start, and then a 40% permit fee later on. So this is going to go on tonight. I realize that staff has recommended that there's going to be a slight reduction in fee revenues, but, you know, where we have other codes and revenues that have always had the stick approach, here we finally have an approach where there's a carrot, and this carrot is something that we can all be proud of. It's a local, national, and a global perspective and issue, and it's a wonderful investment in our future. So who knows, even with this carrot, it might be just that push for a developer or an architect or someone considering a project to go ahead with it, and we certainly need something like that today. So I strongly recommend that you endorse this tonight, and I'm looking forward to helping with it on the Planning Commission, and have a good meeting.
Thank you.
Susan Heineman, resident of Morro Bay. Madam Mayor, City Council members, TV audience, greetings. It is once more time for the annual American University Women's Garden Tour. This year's Garden Tour, our 24th, is April 26th, the last Sunday of this month. Gardens will be available for viewing from noon to 5 p.m. A special bonus this year is that one of our gardens has won a prestigious Sunset Magazine Award and is featured in this month's Sunset Magazine, page 8182, if you want to look it up. In total, there are 8 lovely gardens which are located in Cayucas, Los Osos, Morro Bay. As usual, one of the gardens will feature those homemade delicious cookies and punch. The donation is still $10. What a deal. Tickets are available at Miner's Hardware Store in Morro Bay, Los Osos, Cayucas, Gover Beach, Atascadero. Also, Volumes of Pleasure Bookstore in Los Osos, Coles Bookstore in Morro Bay, and the Pacific Home and Garden Store in San Luis Obispo. Part of the profits each year are spent on scholarships for local 7th grade female students to attend a week-long science camp. One of this year's outstanding recipients is Emma Waddell. She is your next speaker. Please give her the full 3 minutes. See you on the tour.
Thank you, Susan.
To this date, I have made 18 loans, and I have circulated a total of $700 throughout the world in 18 different countries. Previously being a member of the Student Council inspired me to actively campaign for my candidate this election. I plan to run for office this year, and I hope that my comrades will find me a good candidate. I strongly encourage the TV audience to purchase tickets to the garden tours. Remember, when you buy a ticket, you are supporting the American Association of University Women and also myself. Your money helps support young scholars to go to Tech Trek Science Camp this summer. Good day to you all.
Thank you. I think you have a real career ahead of you. I think you'll win your election.
I don't think I could follow that. We're in good hands if all of our students are like that.
Really?
Good job. Madam Mayor, council members, city staff, residents of Morro Bay, I'm Peter Candela, Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce, and I'd just like to go over a couple of things that's coming up from the chamber and go over some visitor stats as well. Our mixer, which is third Thursday of every month, is this Thursday is no different. It's 5:30 to 7, except the change is going to be Frankie and Lola's. That's the restaurant that's in the Front Street parking lot. And that, like I said, is 5:30 to 7. Please come out and join. They just started up. Great restaurant, too. Blessing of the Fleet, which is actually brought to you by the Morro Bay Fishermen's Organization and the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce. It does begin at 12:30 at the North T Pier. It's just, if you haven't experienced this, you should really come out because all the clergy comes out, blesses the harbor and the fleet, and we actually go out onto the boats and throw a rose in each one of the boats that the clergymen bless. So it's really kind of a very special day. So come out and join us. And, of course, the Kite Festival is coming up as well. It starts with the Morro Bay Parade. This time it is Discover Your Better Nature is the theme. This is going to be a really long parade, so you got to come out and see everything. We have all kinds of things going on, and you will see some things you haven't seen before. Just come out and see, and you'll see what I'm talking about. And then following that, of course, is our Kite Festival, and you know where that is. That's at the Rock and the beach just north. We have about 10 kiters coming in, kites ranging from 25 feet to about 200 feet. If you haven't seen anything like this, the only way to describe it is you go in as an adult, but you come out as a kid. So it's really an amazing event. Come out and support these kiters, and we'll bring a lot of folks into our town. October 11th, we're taking a business trip to China. It's one of these special trips. $1,999 to get you a round-trip ticket, all-inclusive trip. So call the chamber about that. Every Saturday, you know, we have the Farmers Market. It's on Main Street and Morro Bay Boulevard. That's 3 to 6. We'll stop right there, and we'll go on to the stats. Real quickly, we had about 1,000 people call in, which is quite a lot for 1 month. We're looking at about 1,600 people that actually physically came in. 625 fulfillments. These are requests for information. You know, here's one that really, it's the visitor packs and relocation packs. We've had over 100 in March. That's amazing. That's just amazing. A lot of people want to come here.
Referrals, we had over 2,200 referrals to our businesses in Morro Bay. Also, the website, I don't know if you've noticed, but the webcam is repaired, so you can go on and actually move the camera 360 degrees. It's really pretty neat if you haven't done that before, and see what Morro Bay looks like from morning until night. Just the web stats, 785,000 hits. That's just amazing. 86,000, and we call these page views. That means that they actually came onto the site and viewed another page. Sessions are when they actually spend time on one of the pages. And it's about 20,000 people looked at that in March. But that means that they spent time on the page, and the average stay on that page is 8 minutes. Very special. There's more, but I think my time is about up.
One last thing.
Yes?
Time of the and date of the parade again, so that people don't miss that.
The date of the parade is Saturday. It's always the third Saturday. It's the 24th of April at 10 o'clock, and we start on Morro Bay Boulevard.
Okay.
Is that
thank
it?
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Hudson said that the carrot can be a lot more effective than the stick, especially for lasting and positive change like this. One day, all tourism will be ecotourism. All building will be green building, and it's thanks to efforts like this. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Joan Solu, and I live in Morro Bay. I also own the Days Inn with my family at the corner of Beach and Main Street. And I also know a project that has recently been passed by our Planning Commission, commonly known as 1050 Morro Avenue or the Dunia Lodge, a 36-room proposed LEED certified or equivalent green lodge that will be the first of its kind in Morro Bay and even the first of the kind in this county. So, having said that, I am keenly interested in D2, reduced fee incentives for green building and low-impact development. When we first came forward with our project, and it was just a concept, an idea, something floating out there, I started to pick the brains of people who knew about that industry, meaning I know about the lodging industry, but they knew about the green portion of it. And so the greening of hotels and the greening of building. And I was asking them, well, exactly how do you do that? What is semi-pervious concrete? How do these solar tubes work? What's the reflective in glass? Tell me about the carbon footprint of a rooftop. And so we've incorporated all of those things into our building project, including a 10,000-square-foot green garden space for the rooftop, which will help the city to meet its carbon reduction. We've also proposed a rainwater garden, reduced runoff, and all kinds of things that will help the city along. So when people saw that my proposal passed through the Planning Commission, oh, Joan, great, congratulations. Congratulations, John. Wonderful. Gosh, you must really be working closely with the city. And I have to say, Bruce Ambo has been instrumental in getting us through this because we have gone through a few different people helping in his office as of late. Yes, while we've been working very closely with Mr. Ambo, we really haven't been working very closely with any incentives. And I would say to you that in this economy, in this recession that we're in, it is key now more than ever for you to bring business into this city and to bring green business in and to push green building would be a way to set this city apart from any other in this county on the Central Coast, or what's considered the Gold Coast, from Ventura to Monterey. I say to you, move forward with these, and please move forward with some more green building. And if and when you do, get these through really quick, because I'm coming up on my fees, okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honorable Counsel and Mayor Peters and staff, my name is Rachel Algelani. I'm a Cayucas resident, and I'm speaking tonight to D2, also the Green Building Incentive initiative that the city has chosen to put forth. And I just wanted to put up on the display, this is the inside cover of the Build It Green guidelines, which when they refer in the staff report to Green Points Rated, these are the types of guidelines they're using. And it just so happens that we were able to customize the guidelines back in 2005 when Slow Green Build started bringing these to the public. And we chose Morro Bay and the estuary because it really speaks to the nature of and beauty of this environment and why we should build green and preserve the spaces that we have with low-impact development and green building. The staff report also talks to the peer review program that Slow Green Build offers, and that's once a month. It's typically the third Tuesday of the month from 5:30 to 7 at the Ludwig Community Center in San Luis Obispo. You can email Slow Green Build through their website, www.slowgreenbuild.org, and go ahead and schedule an appointment. It was interesting that I should come in right behind Joan Sulu because she actually took advantage of the peer review program, and we had a staff of professionals around who all volunteer their time, people who are experts in roof top gardens, in solar hot water heating, in low-impact development and rain gardens, and we were able to sit down with the architects and the developers and actually say, you know, what types of things make sense? And we also have professionals who are versed in the LEED system as well. And so,
good evening, Your Honor, members of the council. My name is Dave Gill. I'm a business owner from Visalia. I'm the skipper of the Sea Scout ship St. Joseph. I'm talking towards item number D1 on your agenda for this evening. We took custody of the St. Joseph last August. We now have 10 members of our scout troop over in Visalia. We have been in touch with the scout executive here in the San Luis Obispo. Excuse me, I got a sore throat. In the San Luis Obispo area, and we're trying to get a group started over here also to help us with the ship. What we're asking for in the letter is either reduced or waived fees until we get the ship out of here. We've been asked by our insurance company to be escorted up the coast because the condition of the vessel isn't the greatest right now. There are no zincs left on the bottom, so we don't know the condition of the hull yet. We do have the fleet coming down for long cruise in July. They will be returning in early August, at which time we'll be departing Morro Bay up the coast with the rest of the fleet under escort of two ships over 100 feet long and about six that are under 90 feet long. What they do is we take the kids down to Disneyland for a day, take them out to the islands, let them go scuba diving. We do have certified scuba instructors. We try to get the kids out of the inner city and get them involved with something that they can make a career out of if they want to. I personally was a Sea Scout back in 1968. But not trying to age myself. But anyways, I'm just trying to get back to what I received from the program myself. And every penny that's gone towards that vessel since we've taken it has come out of my own pocket personally. We get no funding from anyone else. So I am asking if you would please give us a hand. We have been offered, when we do come back, free moorage if Mr. Loving's proposal ever gets through for the cannery dock down in the south of the Morro Bay. But we're doing whatever we can to keep it as reduced as possible. Okay. Again, thank you very much for your time. Have a great evening. We do have a crew down on the ship right now removing more garbage.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Okay, we'll bring it back to council. I just wanted to make one comment. It's obviously it was a very emotional situation for the woman with her dog, but we are getting more and more complaints about loose dogs on the beach and around town. And so we have asked Animal Services and our own police department to step up the citations for loose dogs. So please keep your dog on a leash. It may be friendly with you, but it may not be friendly with somebody else's dog or a child. And it has. We've been receiving a lot of complaints lately. So please be a responsible dog owner. Keep your dog on a leash unless you're in a designated dog run area. So thank you. Any other comments on the public comments?
All right, we've got a few minutes. Let's go to our consent agenda. And did anyone want to pull anything? Nope. Okay, I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Okay. Who moved the motion?
I thought you. Oh, go ahead. I move to approve the consent agenda.
That was the move. This was the second. All in favor?
I'm sorry.
Aye. Opposed? None. All right. With that, we'll take a short break, and we'll come back with our public hearings. I know. Okay, as soon as I can get the council back up, we'll get back to work. Okay, we shall move ahead to our public hearing items. First one, B1, it was a resolution initializing proceedings to levy the annual assessment for the Cloisters Park and Open Space Landscaping and Lighting Maintenance Assessment District. And this is going to be handled by Susan Slayton in the absence of Joe Woods.
Thank you, Mayor Peters. Good evening. Staff is recommending that the City Council adopt Resolution 1509, which initiates the proceedings to levy the annual assessment for the Cloisters Park and Open Space. The Cloisters Park and Open Space Assessment District was formed in 1996, and the city began the maintenance of parkland and open space in 1999.
All right, and item B2. Susan, again, a resolution initiating proceedings to levy the annual assessment for the North Point National Area Landscaping and Lighting Maintenance Assessment District.
Thank you. This evening, staff is recommending that the City Council adopt Resolution 16-09, which initiates the proceedings to levy the annual assessment for the North Point Natural Area. The North Point Natural Area was formed in 1996, and the city began the maintenance of the natural area in 1997. Each year, the City Council must hold a series of three public hearings to confirm the levy of assessment for the upcoming fiscal year. Tonight is the first of those three. Upon adoption of Resolution 16-09, the second public hearing to review the engineer's report and to notice the intent to levy the assessment is scheduled for consideration at the May 11, 2009 City Council's regular meeting. And that concludes my staff report, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
All right. Any questions on this one? All right. This is a public hearing also. Anyone wishing to speak on this issue, please come forward. And seeing none, we'll bring it back to council. Can I hear a motion?
Motion to approve 1609.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. All right. What we're going to do, item B3 is going to be a rather complex issue. So since we have some people in the audience to speak on the other issues, we're going to skip ahead to item B4. And that is the introduction and first reading of ordinance number 546, establishing the Morro Bay Tourism Business Improvement District, the MBTBID. And Rob, your report, please.
Yes. Good evening, Mayor and Council. This process now has been going on for a while, as you know. It started out back in 3 years ago when it was first brought to your attention about the formation of a San Luis Obispo Business Improvement District. It went through that process, but because of the delays and other issues involved, the City Council instructed staff to begin the process of creating a citywide business improvement district for the hotel industry. You initiated the process to form the citywide TBID on February 23rd, 2009, and adopted a resolution of intent indicating your intention to establish the TBID for the benefit of the tourism promotion and marketing in the city of Morro Bay. The TBID would be a 3% assessment of the gross room rates for the initial year and a 2% for the years thereafter. Following the resolution of intent, staff sent out the notice information to all the hoteliers that have the ability to vote on this business improvement district. We had our first public meeting, which was on March 23rd, 2009, and now you're at your protest hearing, which is today. The city clerk has not received any protests at all for the formation of this bid. We suggest that you open it up for public hearing, and after taking the public hearing, determine whether there's more than 50% protest of the votes, and if not, that you introduce the ordinance, which is attached, which is the first reading of that ordinance, by title and number only, and that we then move on to the second reading in 2 weeks. With that, I'll answer any questions that you might have. There was one item on the ordinance that was pointed out to me that should be changed, and that would be on page 2. The definition under 3.60.020D for hotel, that definition should read, the very last word in that paragraph should read vacation rentals instead of vacation homes.
Thank you. Okay, any questions for staff? All right, this is a public hearing. Anyone wishing to speak on the BID, please come forward. And no one here for that either. Okay. We'll bring it back to council. May I hear a motion?
I move for a motion for introduction and first reading of ordinance number 546 by number and title only.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. I'm sorry. Discussion. Go ahead.
My only comment on this is I was more than willing to, I support the concept. I was more than willing to go along with the 2%. I'll be voting no simply because I think the 3% is 1% too much.
It's only for 1 year, you know.
I know that.
Okay. All right. Other discussion?
I would just note that the County Board of Supervisors postponed their decision on this item in hopes that more of the agencies, the cities, would consider going in with that as they start to format theirs. And I have my hesitancy still, too, because I think we need to be part of that. But I'll probably be voting yes just to get the ball rolling.
Okay. Another comment?
And I just wanted to confirm with Mr. Schultz today, which I did, that we will be addressing the administrative fee issue.
All right. So 4-1 with Mr. Grantham opposed.
Okay, and this is the introduction and first reading of ordinance number 546, establishing the Morro Bay Tourism Business Improvement District, fixing the boundaries thereof, and providing for the levy of a business assessment to be paid by the hotel businesses in such district.
Thank you. All right, then we'll go to item B5, which is the introduction and first reading of the ordinance number 547, prohibiting the establishment of medical marijuana dispensaries. Rob.
Yes, this item is back to you also based on your instruction at your first meeting in December. Briefly, in 1996, California voters established Proposition 215, the Compassionate Use Act, which protects qualified patients and their primary caregivers from prosecution under California laws for possession or cultivation of marijuana to treat serious illnesses pursuant to a doctor's recommendation. However, under federal law, has no currently accepted medical use for the cultivation and possession of marijuana or distribution thereof. We've been through, and I go into great detail of the law regarding Prop 215 and the issues between state and federal law and the differences there. And we've been through this with having our own, and I think you're aware of the issues with the one medical marijuana dispensary we had in the city being closed down by the federal government. And so I do support the ban of it, but also know that council has had this issue in front of them and understands there also is the need for the medical marijuana for serious ill patients. So I know you're struggling with the ban as staff has also. But I do think it's still, and even though we've heard from the federal government and from the U.S. Attorney General that there will be no more raids was his first statement, and then he backed off of that and said there will be no more raids as long as they comply with federal and state law.
I still think that we're in the best position at this point in time to ban it. And if you feel that our goal is still to allow it with regulations, that staff continues to work forward and bring forward an ordinance that would allow it. Just since the new year and the moratorium has lapsed, we have gotten many inquiries for this. And without the current regulations, staff is very concerned that they can go in areas where you might not want them. There could be a proliferation of them. These are all things that we can regulate, is how many, where they're located, and make certain that we get sales tax. But we need to have those regulations in place. So support the ban, but also if council does want to direct staff to begin working on regulations, in the hope also that this federal and state law gets resolved through amendments, and it might be even the decriminalization of marijuana is a possibility in the next 6 months to a year. So with that, I'll open up for any questions. I do go into quite a bit of detail in my staff report on the law and the cases that have been decided, but I didn't want to spend that much time, since you do have quite a few other items, and I think you all are aware of the issues involved here.
Okay. Any questions for Rob?
It was my understanding when Eric Holder made the announcement about no longer raiding the places, he didn't mention federal law. He mentioned as long as they comply with state law.
It might have been just state law.
Yeah.
But there is the issue of how do you comply with state law, in that the Attorney General's opinion now has come down and stated, though, that you medical marijuana storefronts, as they currently exist, do not comply with state law. So yes, that's part of the issue. They have to be your traditional nonprofit co-ops. And certainly the one that was here was not your nonprofit co-op. It
right.
was a...
very much profitable.
Yes.
My concern, you know, this is not your grandfather's world we're living in now, and there's legislation being put forward to tax this product, and apparently it's the second largest cash crop in the state. I don't want to be the only town that doesn't realize some tax revenue off this. I agree that we need to be selective as far as how many and where they're placed and a whole host of other issues that go along with it. But in my view, I kind of see this going forward now, especially since Eric Holder made that statement. There's been a whole lot of folks that have pursued opening up establishments such as this now. So there's not too much
just the opportunity to regulate and make sure that it's a good fit for the community if we do decide to do that.
Yes, I have my concerns in that we certainly do have right now one business license and possibly, I think, maybe even a second that's already processing their business license. And if they are in the area that does not require a CUP, they will have no review from the Planning Commission or the City Council to put conditions on those businesses. They're entitled to it under our current ordinances, as we did before, which is just in the drugstore area is how we defined them previously. And so I am concerned on what conditions we can attach to a business license, if that's even legal to do that. And so, because you want to gain the sales tax, if it's not actually in our ordinance for that, we could lose those sales tax unless the state comes forward with regulations. I'd rather have those regulations in our ordinance. So, you know, I'm still looking for the cooling off period for the 3 to 6 months for us to develop the regulations. I think we'd be better off if not, and a council says they don't want this regulation for 3 to 6 months, then we'll process those two business licenses as they are, or as I'm not sure if they require CUP, and we'll move forward.
Madam Mayor.
And see where it goes from. It is a public hearing, so.
Yes, I know. Just a follow-up question, if you're done, Mr. Smuckler.
I just had one more question. Do you feel like you could develop an ordinance within 3 months?
I could certainly have a draft. I'm not certain if it's going to answer all the questions, but I can certainly have a draft of it. My goal was to place this within currently working on regulations under Chapter 5 that deal with some of the problem businesses that could that seem to be cropping up in beach towns, which is tattoo parlors, massage parlors, and medical marijuana dispensaries. Those are on the radar list for most coastal cities, and we don't have adequate protections for any of those three. And there's a couple other ones, but those are the main ones coastal cities are starting to find problems with. And so it's all under Chapter 5. I'd like to get them all to you at the same time. And whether I can do that in 3 months kind of depends on what other issues come up. We'll be done with the bid, which has taken up quite a bit of time, and hopefully then that's when I can devote the time necessary for this. So your answer is it's quite possible I could be back with this in 3 months. I certainly, if that's the requirement, I'll come back in 3 months, at least with what I've got so far.
Danny? Would not a moratorium suffice as rather than a ban?
You know, we did the moratorium for the full time. It brings up an interesting concept in that we let it lapse, and whether you could bring back another one, it might be challenged because you did the moratorium for the longest time, and we didn't adopt an ordinance at that particular time. So I'd be concerned whether it could be challenged. I'd feel more comfortable with doing the ban and then just repealing it.
Can we do a temporary ban?
Oh, you certainly could put a sunset clause on it. Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Okay, any other questions? This is a public hearing. Anyone wishing to speak on this issue, please come forward and limit your comments to 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. My name is David Major. I would just like to state a few positive impacts that a compassionate medical marijuana dispensary might bring to the community. First and foremost, as you mentioned, Rick, the tax benefits for the city. And also, just to have a natural alternative for medicine other than pharmaceutical chemicals. A lot of people, you know, are concerned about being green and stuff these days. And right now, if anyone wants to use medical marijuana, they have to drive all the way down to Santa Barbara to a dispensary down there or up to Santa Cruz. There's no place for the residents of the Central Coast to get medical marijuana. And I think it would also be a positive impact to, you know, be open and have it regulated instead of, you know, people going, you know, to the black, let's say the black market or whatever, you know, buying it on the street. It's a opportunity for the city to regulate it and, you know, to have, as Robert said, to have the shops where, you know, will be the least amount of nuisance to the community. And and it also makes it safe for the residents of the Central Coast, a safe place for them to acquire this substance. That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
My name is Kent Canella, Madam Mayor, City Council. I'd just like to read what Eric Holder said. Back 2 months ago. What the president said during the campaign will be surprising. I came in 2 months ago. We spent 2 years with the county of San Luis Obispo helping them write the regulations for the county, which was very successful. I came in 2 months ago to meet with Rob and ask him where your moratorium was at. I was told the moratorium was over. Spent the next month looking for the right location in the city. And found a landlord that was willing to work with us. 2 days after I came, 2 days before I came in to apply for my business license, I was told this would be put on the agenda after talking with Rob, telling him about what I was doing. I feel like I'm kind of caught in an odd spot here. We agree with regulation. You need good regulation. There's no doubt about that. But we help write those regulations with the County of San Luis Obispo, with the safety, the security cameras, the age limits, and all that. We're here to provide a professional service, nonprofit, collective corporation in this city that will pay taxes. And I would hope you would not prohibit the medical cannabis collectives at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, we'll bring it back to council. Yes, Rob.
What Eric Holder, which is our U.S. Attorney General, said in March was that it was both federal and state law. I'm trying to get his comments here. He said the policy, they will not go after people who violate, only if they violate both federal and state law. But he didn't say what that meant as far as how to spell it out. But he was quick to add that the law enforcement officers will target anyone who tries to use medical marijuana laws as a shield for illegal activity. And that's what I'm still concerned about, is there are the businesses, even Ken's proposed business, is in that gray area on whether it's actually a dispensary or whether it's actually a co-op. And those should be specifically designated in our ordinance should be clear on that to make certain that they don't fall in trouble or their property owners. One thing that Ken wanted me that really needed to bring this forward is he wanted my office to write a letter for the landowner that said this was legal and that he'd be able to have this dispensary. Well, I'm not going to do that because I still don't know whether the federal government's going to come in and try to take away that property. So that's why I still think there's regulations that are required. And under the certain circumstances, if any property owner contacts me, I would tell them they're absolutely crazy to rent to a medical marijuana dispensary or a co-op because you could lose your property if the federal government comes in and determines there was illegal activities there. So I still think this area of laws is up in the air and is still concerning to me, seeing that Charles Lynch is going to do 5 years for something that he was told was legal by federal and state government also, and even by the city. So I do have concerns.
Okay. I think I'm going to go first on the comments because I think Rob and I are the ones who have been the, lightning points on this one for the city. And, in fact, I did go down to Los Angeles and testified for 2 minutes at Charles Lynch's trial because all that they would allow me to say, well, the question was, do you find him a law-abiding citizen? And I said, yes, he complied with all the laws of our city and state. And they said, objection, state law was not allowed, and I was dismissed. So for whatever reason, the single marijuana dispensary in our county was targeted to be the one, to be the example. I don't think it was fair. I think that Charles Lynch was operating a good business. Obviously, he was very upfront with the whole thing. Got a business license, had a ribbon cutting. People could call up and take a tour anytime they wanted. He was not hiding anything. And yet he was made an example. And when he did reopen, which he did for a couple of days, his landlord was informed that his property could be confiscated by the federal government. So that's, I totally agree with Rob. This council and previous councils have all voted in favor of medical marijuana. We all support the use of it and the people who need it, and I know it's unfair to have to go to Santa Cruz and Santa Barbara, but it's also unfair that they still have dispensaries operating, and ours was shut down. So for whatever reason, I don't want to put somebody else in the jeopardy that Charles Lynch has been put in and put another landlord in that jeopardy either. It is very unfair. I don't understand it. I don't like it. But I think that at this point, the safest thing that we can do for our citizens, our county right now, is to say no to this until the federal situation changes, until those laws are compatible. We're putting people at risk to allow this. And I hate to say that because it's not what I believe is right. But I can't see doing anything else than this right now until that federal and state discrepancy is resolved.
So I think 6 months might be a better point to go from. It'll give us time to see what happens with them and might give us a better idea. But 3 months might be a little short on that.
No?
I'm in agreement with Betty. I think this is an important time for us to continue to be actually proactive on developing more of a concept about what we think is appropriate for our community and answering some of the questions and developing an ordinance that allows us to answer the issues that we have, and those to me seem to be something we all agree with: its location, the quality of the business and the management of that business, the responsibility of that business, and also receiving the financial benefit from that business. So from my conversation with Mr. Schultz, I felt like he had a pretty good grasp on what we could do to give us that control and the ability to regulate and tax and also provide a good service for our community. So I'm interested. I think I'd like to have a little more of the conversation about the timelines on a temporary ban, and I'm ready to move ahead.
Carla?
Well, I'm inclined to follow Janice's lead here, because I, as I said back in December, because this isn't something that I'm sorry that the applicant feels that this is something that just came his way. We actually passed this back in December before the ban expired. It just unfortunately has come about a little slower than it should have, and the wind changed a little bit. But I don't see the federal and state laws still coming together, and for me, it comes back to the same situation as I had stated earlier back in December, using the example of an ADA where the federal and state laws are not the same. I'm not interested, as much as I can support the, you know, people wanting to have a co-op. You know, my understanding, you know, obviously Mr. Lynch may have had other things he was doing that we aren't privy to. I would like to believe that he wasn't put in jail just to be made an example of. So despite we had a ribbon cutting, doesn't mean we know everything that went on. So I'm not interested in Morro Bay having a dispensary on the boulevard. If it's such a great deal that we're missing out on, how come nobody else in San Luis County's done it yet? We can't be the only ones that everybody has to drive to Santa Barbara or Santa Cruz, and this is the only town that everybody seems to be coming to, and nowhere else in this county. I just kind of find that hard to believe that nobody else wants a dispensary or co-op in their town, in this county, just us. That tells me there's a reason. And I'm just not inclined at this time to feel that with the federal and state laws still the way they are, that I want to support this.
All right, we've got a suggestion of a 6-month ban, which would give us some time to see how the federal situation falls out and put together some limitations. And is that something that you could go with, Carla, to visit again in 6 months?
I'm willing to look at it again in 6 months, but I mean, I don't know what's going to change.
Well, it would be, we'd see if the federal law has changed, then it would be something that we could pursue. Go ahead, Rick.
So, Rob, but when Mr. Lynch was operating, we didn't realize tax revenue from that.
No, we didn't. No.
So, if hypothetically, if we did, we would only get the set rate of sales tax, and that would be it, or would there be an additional? Would we have?
It should be the set rate. There's the position of most medical marijuana dispensaries that say we are not actually selling any product. We are providing the caregiving service, and the medical marijuana is free. We're actually providing the service of the caregiving is what the cost is. That's the way they have claimed that there is no sales tax. But you certainly can write in your ordinance, if you have one, that you have to register with the state franchise tax board, provide us with that certificate, and pay sales tax. We don't have an ordinance that said that, so we couldn't require, and it was just a business license, we could not require that condition of Charles Lynch's, so we didn't receive any sales tax from that business.
I mean the Board of Equalization?
Yeah, Board of Equalization. Yeah.
Also, I understand that there was a dispensary that was set to open in Orchid. They were all ready to go, and then the next day they were supposed to open, and it was closed for some reason. Any insight into that?
No, I don't know anything about it.
Okay. I know that there's a bill being put forward by a representative from San Francisco to tax it $100 an ounce and break it down, you know, that way. So that's something other over and above regular sales tax. So that's why that was my question.
I'd have to look, but I'm certain you could probably put a surcharge on any.
Mr. Grantham, was there something else?
If you want that sunset clause, I have the language for you. Is that what you wanted?
In addition to.
Okay.
My motion, do you want me to give me the language for the sunset?
What I would suggest you put in as on the ordinance under Section 6, this ordinance shall expire, and then whatever date you want, from the effective date of this execution, unless prior to that date the City Council takes affirmative action to extend the ordinance.
Are you on the front page?
That would be on page 3 of 3.
Oh, ordinance. So you're adding a Section 6.
Yeah. Okay. Section 6, again, would read, this ordinance shall expire, and then whatever date you decide, from the effective date of this execution, unless prior to that date the City Council takes affirmative action to extend the ordinance.
Okay. So what date would you suggest for your purposes getting it to
June,
us?
June, July. October?
That would...
2009?
Yes. That would be excellent for me.
Okay. All right, Betty, go ahead and make your motion.
My motion is that we direct staff to come back with an ordinance that limits location, kind, and includes sales tax for a co-op. I assume co-ops are nonprofit, therefore just sales tax, by no later than October of 2009. And that I would amend Section 9.06020 to read a medical marijuana co-op. No, I guess we need to say dispensary in this one. She'll now...
excuse me, just a second. Should these be two separate motions, Rob? Would that be better?
Yeah, actually, if you want to do the banning of the ordinance first, and then the second one would be best. But it's, yeah, I mean, if you want it all in one, because...
I don't need to do all in one.
Okay.
I prefer not to do the ban. So I'll just make a motion that we direct staff to come back with an ordinance no later than October 2009 that allows for co-op.
Can you include surcharge in that?
I don't, let's talk about that. I don't know.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm not sure what the motion is now. And I'm sorry to interrupt. I just thought they should be two things to clarify.
Yeah, but, I think
okay, what's the
that's
motion
fine.
Now?
I'll finish my motion, and then we'll discuss. My motion is that we direct staff to come back with an ordinance that allows for medical co-op inside the city limits of Morro Bay that identifies location, kind of facility, and with sales tax, and anything else that staff thinks is pertinent.
Okay.
And it be no later than October of 2009.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All right, discussion.
I'd like surcharge put in that also.
Could you define what that might mean?
Well, I think that staff needs to come up and give us some estimates. You know, whether we want to say, I mean, off the cuff, similar to what's going on in San Francisco as far as $100 an ounce surcharge. That's just an example, but I think that if we're going to do this, I'd like to see as much city benefit as possible, and I think a surcharge in there is appropriate.
How do you, and this just for discussion, if this is a nonprofit co-op, how do you justify a surcharge when we don't do that on other items or sales stuff in the city?
This is pretty much different from everything else, too. I think it has its own merits and demerits, and I'd like to see it made worth our while.
It appears the city of San Francisco is doing a $50 surcharge per ounce. So there, you know, it seems that's just the research I need to do, though, to find out what the legality of that, how they're doing the surcharge. I certainly can bring that back in the draft, and then you guys can determine whether you want it in or out. I think that's more of my research and everything that's possible, and then you could put that surcharge in or not put it in.
But wouldn't that be for a for-profit organization as opposed to a co-op? I mean, the fact that
you're looking at more your typical storefront dispensary. Now, all of them have to be nonprofit. That's a difference than just a co-op, which this current ordinance still allows for co-ops. If someone's a caregiver in co-op, there's no ban to this. I have two patients. You could raise that up to 5 to 10 patients in here, and someone could still have that many and not be under this ban, and I think you'd be okay because no one would operate and pay rent on a storefront if they can only have a limited number of customers.
Well, it seems to me that Betty's motion was wide enough that it would cover all the options in your research, right? Okay, so is that all right? Why don't we...
So do you feel like that's covered, that Mr. motion? Grantham?
Okay, I'm okay with that.
Okay.
My only discussion item would be that we give ourselves enough time to have this discussion so that when this sunsets, we're fairly prepared with an ordinance or
that would comply with both state and federal law. How does that sound as the motion?
Yes.
No?
I don't like the idea about the state and federal law, but the rest was okay.
All right, so now we need another motion to ban
Let me make sure the city clerk is... Are you clear on the motion? No, she didn't like it. So I'd like to have the motion repeated to make sure we've got it as what my direction...
That's how we were voted. It was to come back in October 2009, no later than, with an ordinance that would allow for the location and the nature, the kind of facility, and with sales tax and any other items that the city attorney thought appropriate. So there were four items to it.
Okay.
Oh. Yes, certainly.
And then the next motion needs to be, and I'll do it, I move that we ban the establishment of medical marijuana dispensaries until such an ordinance is presented to the council for a decision.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, 3-2 with Noah and Betty opposed. Okay. I think we got that one taken care of.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's
now, we're going to have... Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Go ahead.
This is the introduction and first reading of Ordinance Number 547, an ordinance of the City of Morro Bay adding Section 9.06 to the Morro Bay Municipal Code, prohibiting the establishment of medical marijuana dispensaries in the City of Morro Bay.
Okay, and that's with the addition of the expiration on that, so we have that.
No. The
well,
motion
that was my just mo- my motion was that it was a temporary ban.
Excuse me, Madam May, did you amend it to say October 2009?
No, I said until it was brought back, which was...
Until it's brought back,
okay.
But that didn't have... So you want the language of Section 6 added that I mentioned earlier?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and that date would be not till you brought back. I need a date certain, which would be October 1st.
Okay.
And, and is that still the vote of 3-2 because I didn't have that language?
Four.
Let's re-vote.
All right, let's vote on it once again. Well, okay.
Yes.
Just for clarification, we are going to add that expiration of October 1st, and let's vote again. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
One. Okay. 4-1, Betty opposed. All right. Our next item is going to take a while. Does anyone want a break beforehand? Short one? Okay. Quick break, and then we're going to go to item B3.
I've got both of those.
Good work.
Good job.
Well, okay, it's not going to be permitted through the city, but we could.
Okay, we're back.
It's permitted through state parks.
And we're going to item B3. Which is adoption of a mitigated negative declaration and consideration of a concept plan for a vesting tentative subdivision map, conditional use permit, coastal development permit, for a custom residential 10-lot conservation subdivision and open space easement at 1305 Teresa Drive.
And this is Eileen. Bruce, you want to introduce Eileen to us?
I'd like to introduce Eileen Nygaard. She's going to be doing the presentation on the staff report. If you have any questions, we've got other staff available that had a little bit more background on the project. But Eileen will drive you through the project. This, again, as you indicated, Mayor, the concept review of this proposal.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. The agent for the applicant at 1305 Teresa has prepared a presentation for this evening, so I'll be giving you a brief site description and highlight some of the changes that occurred after the Planning Commission hearing that was had occurred in February 2008. The site for the 10-lot residential conservation subdivision is located in the RAPD zone at the southern entrance to the city limits, adjacent to grazing land and the Senior Facility Center. The site is what I call north, some people call west, of the Seashell Senior Care Facility. Scenic qualities are dominated by rural grazing lands and the introduction of urban fringe. It is development area and open space area. The open space is intended to conserve resources such as natural vegetation and scenic resources. Each lot in this proposal will have a conserved open space component and a building envelope within the area shown as the development limits. The graphic on the left describes how the envelope works within the development limits. The total building envelope is proposed to be 6,600 square feet. The staff report incorrectly stated this is 5,600 square feet. So the 6,600 square feet of building envelope includes a 3,600 square foot building footprint, 1,000 square feet private fenced yard, and 2,000 square foot unfenced yard. The envelope is proposed to be located somewhere within the development limits of each lot. The original concept was composed of 10 residential lots with an additional lot for open space. The current version is composed of 10 residential lots with lot lines to the center of the private street and an open space easement across the lots. The open space currently provided is between 45% to 46% and meets the requirement for a conservation subdivision. Drainage for the developed area will be required to drain to the street, while the natural open space will continue to follow the natural drainage patterns. A complete list of concept changes is located in the staff report on pages 10 and 11. The original photo simulations studied and found in the mitigated negative declaration studied the impacts of an 18-foot, 6-inch height limit on the upper lots. The depiction of this height is not shown on the lower lots. There's another photo from a different viewpoint. Recently, the applicant has produced a conceptual visual simulation with one house for your review and potential project landscaping. The full set of boards you have up there are available for your review. The sections indicate proposed tract landscaping and potential landscaping for Lot 4. Here's a depiction of a typical house shown on Lot 4. Typical building characters shown here and guidelines for development are described in the design guidelines. The conservation subdivision contains an open space provision to maintain the natural vegetation. Landscaping is also proposed by the tract to provide screening. You can see the existing character and the proposed character. The action tonight is to adopt the mitigated negative declaration if the study is found to be adequate and to consider approval of the concept plan. And now, the applicant, or the agent for the applicant, Kathy Novak, is here to continue her presentation.
Dennis, did you want to ask staff questions?
questions first before I start?
Did you want to ask staff questions before I start? Great. Good evening, Madam Mayor and Council. My name is Kathy Novak, and I'm here this evening representing the applicant for the 10-lot subdivision project. I'd like to thank staff for their time and assistance with this project. However, I must respectfully disagree with several items in the report, Exhibit A, findings for approval, and Exhibit B, conditions for approval. For my presentation this evening, I'd like to cover the following topics. One is a brief project history. Two would be a project overview. Three will be the staff report and conditions. Fourthly, the findings for approval. And lastly, the permitting process. First, this project was submitted to the city in 2004. It was reviewed by the Subdivision Review Board in October of 2004, and then again in March of 2006. It went before the Planning Commission in September of 2007 and was continued to a later date to allow time for more information to be developed. At the time, the project was being processed under the city's old subdivision ordinance. I think we all agree that the old subdivision ordinance was ambiguous at best. Because of this, the applicant submitted a request to change the processing from the old ordinance to the new one. The new subdivision ordinance has much more detail and criteria for the city to use in evaluating this project. Additionally, a conservation subdivision is to clarify the nature of protecting environmental attributes by clustering the development. The intent of the ordinance is to provide flexibility to allow for creativity and interconnected and subdivide 4.75 acres into 10 lots. As staff has noted, the lots will range in size from 14,000 square feet to over 30,000 square feet. This conservation subdivision that requires a minimum of 40% of the tract to be in permanent open space. The tract map as presented has 40.2% open space, but what is important to note here is that of the 40.2%, it does not include the impervious areas of Teresa Drive, the sidewalks on Teresa Drive and the cul-de-sac, or the 20-foot driveway widths, which are outside the building envelopes. Along with the open space, the tract establishes building envelopes with development limits. Within each building envelope, the property owners will be allowed a 3,600-square-foot footprint in which to locate the home and the garage. The placement of this footprint will be determined by the individual owners at the time they submit for permits. Additionally, with the building envelope, the owners will be allowed a 1,000-square-foot private fenced yard and limited to the eastern side of the home only to keep it away from the view from Highway 1, and also a 2,000-square-foot unfits private open space area. The owners will have their choice of amenities in the 1,000-square-foot area. However, the 2,000-square-foot area is restricted to landscaping, retaining walls, uncovered above-grade decks, patios, and walkways, and shall be integral and adjacent to the house. The remaining area of each lot, not included in the open space easement established on the map, will be left close to its existing natural environmental state. Lastly, all the landscaping shall adhere to the design manual's approved plant palette. Fences are not allowed. Play structures and storage are also not allowed in the open space. I've got one slide here that in it shows what I'd like to indicate is the open space requirements. This is the area that I've just detailed. The blue represents the final open space based upon using a block technique to represent the homes and the yard spaces within the predetermined building envelope so that you could see what it would conceptually look like when it's all done. The applicant has created a philosophy and an image on how this project should be developed. So the design manual is an integral part of the overall tract design. It shows their vision and respect for a special concept we call living gently with the land. It expresses an approach to an architectural design that is about respecting the existing character of the place and the unique context of each building site. Since the manual is so important, I'd like to take just a few moments to cover some important highlights. First, all the homes will require City of Morro Bay Planning Commission approval. Secondly, the building height is limited to 18 feet 6 inches following the natural grade. This will position the home in such a way to minimize grading, avoid significant natural landforms, and step the floor levels to conform to the natural grade. Thirdly, architectural treatments including roof design, exterior wall materials, finishes, fencing, and more are detailed. Fourth, there are restrictions for parking for cars, boats, and RVs. Fifth, there are sections in the manual on vegetation management, grading, and drainage. And lastly, there is an appendix to assist homeowners with the green building techniques and information. At the time of development, each homeowner will be responsible for providing to the city for review and approval of the design that is consistent with this manual, city regulations, and also a landscape screening plan for the individual home. In other words, the requirements are established for the, in the zoning ordinance, section 17.40.300, which is the precise plan. Now I'd like to cover the staff report and the conditions in Exhibit B. First, I have provided you a copy with the condition language we are asking for the council's support for specific modifications to. Since you have my paper, there are numerous changes, and I will just take time to cover some of them. Under standard conditions, condition number one, I would request that an amendment to the staff report, findings, and conditions of approval be prepared and attached to this report for the file. This will be important in the future so that there are no misunderstandings. Under planning number 15, planning conditions, reads in the condition number 18, open space easement. The open space easement cannot be restricted to a natural vegetation preservation only. There are acceptable items listed in the city's subdivision ordinance that are allowed and within the open space easement. They include such items as private access, public utilities, drainage, pedestrian pathways, and landscaping. Since this track map includes several of the components I have just listed within the open space easement, the condition must be modified in order to allow public utilities and drainage, for example. Condition number 19, CCNRs. First, the track map establishes the open space easement. Secondly, the CCNRs provide for the provisions for continued maintenance of the open space, the road, and the utilities. Next, I sent a request to staff asking that a condition be added to that states, quote, the design manual shall be used as a basis for the City of Morro Bay Planning Commission approval for the necessary permits of the homes, end quote. This is an important condition that needs to be added in order for the city to have approval. Size, foundations, color, and et cetera should be considered when the Planning Commission reviews the project and uses the design manual for consistency. Next item, fire management number F. I must first object that this is the first time, again, that we've seen or heard anything of this additional setback for fire management. Staff is recommending a rear yard setback of 30 feet from the building envelope and 20 feet for lots 9 and 10 for defensible space. Each lot has incorporated a rear yard setback by establishing the building envelope line on the track map. If staff recommendations are accepted, each lot will lose an additional 30 feet with the exception of lots 9 and 10 at 20 feet of the building area that has been created by this map. In other words, on lots 1 through 3, buildable area will be reduced to only 46 feet in depth. On lot 4, it will be 41, and lots 9 and 10, it will be 40, and it goes so on with the rest of the lots. This depth is smaller than the majority of homes in Morro Bay. Additionally, and most importantly, this condition not only far exceeds the state fire code, but staff is rewriting the fire code. Next item is maintenance number I. We have initiated the change from a homeowners association, HOA, to a current proposal for a couple important reasons. The first being that we clearly heard from some planning staff that an HOA was troublesome, and based upon their experience, it was questionable if it was a good way to handle this project since there was only 10 lots. After hearing these comments on more than one occasion, the project team decided to further investigate the alternatives. We informed the staff planner on this project that we would do so. We consulted with First American Title Company in San Luis Obispo because they have handled numerous subdivisions and projects over the years and are extremely familiar with the Department of Real Estate and, more accurately, what the department is currently accepting. This project needs to go to the Department of Real Estate after it receives the city approvals. First American strongly recommended that the project withdraw the HOA concept and proceed with the maintenance agreements and other obligations as presented in the CCNRs. The maintenance procedures are clearly outlined in the draft CCNRs. Before the final map is approved and recorded, the CCNRs with all the agreements will be reviewed by the city attorney, which is in condition number 19, and we respectfully ask that the council support this as presented and leave the legal requirements to the qualified attorneys. Next item, condition number 20, colors and materials. All of these items are covered in the design manual, so we are asking you to remove this particular condition since it would be incorporated under condition number 19. Under environmental conditions, first, aesthetics conditions number 2 and 3. This is covered in the design manual, and the conditions should provide for consistency with this manual. The next item, the biological resources condition number 2. We are asking that both the tract and the individual lot open spaces be used for on-site mitigation purposes. Next item, biological resources condition number 3. We are asking to have this condition modified to exclude the 1,000 square foot private yard area. The owner should be allowed some latitude in the private area for other plants than set forth in the landscape palette in the design manual. Under land use planning, condition number 1, this condition was not discussed in the staff report, so it is unclear as to how staff arrived at the construction value of $200 a square foot. Staff has assumed that the maximum allowed area of 3,600 square feet of building footprint will be utilized by the home. However, in this case, it needs to be further refined to establish the construction costs. For example, a garage would not cost $200 per square foot to build, finished or unfinished, but it is required to be included in the allowable 3,000 square foot building footprint. If we look at the city's permit valuation, it states the dwellings cost $94.09, finished garages are at $46.10, and decks at $22.29. Even if these numbers were doubled, it would still not equate to an overall cost of $200 per square foot for the construction. For example, the workforce housing cost per square foot is approximately $150 per square foot, and these are final numbers that we've received on the workforce housing. While the construction is different than would be on the homes, the workforce project has a tremendous amount of grading that inflates the overall square footage cost versus a relatively no grading on the 10-lot site. This would make the square footage cost approximately the same. We did some further checking today on the Internet and also a building cost program, and the architect has shared with me that it appears, also consulted with some local construction companies, and has shared with me that it appears that $150 to $175 per square foot is a reasonable expected cost in today's market for construction costs for a project like this. So I would respectfully ask the council to reconsider the cost per square foot number and or recalculate the total square footage in a manner that is consistent with the building permit valuations. Under transportation circulation, condition number 2. This condition states that the sidewalks shall be installed on both sides of the private roads. The combination of the on-site parking and the Teresa Drive parking should be an adequate number of parking spaces for this development. Staff is also incorrect that there's a lack of screening space on Teresa Drive. The landscape plan clearly indicates screening adjacent to the Caltrans fence area. Additionally, the parking on the Teresa Drive will be for guest parking, which is temporary in nature. There will be not cars parked there each day, all day. This section of the Teresa Drive is considerably lower than Highway 1, and with the screening proposed, will reduce the visibility of the cars that you'll be able to see from the highway. In summary, in keeping the 9 parking spaces on the cul-de-sacs does not justify the need to impact the open space, the character of the subdivision, visuals of the wider road, and additionally, approximately 4,100 square feet of impervious surface that are needed for the parking spaces in the wider road. And lastly, the city approved the Coral Avenue subdivision project with a 20-foot wide road, access road, and no parking. Now I'd like to go over the findings for the approval in Exhibit A. The staff report is void of any findings for the Subdivision Map Act and the Coastal Development Permit. These are important sections that must accompany this report and approval from the City Council. I would direct you to the other projects that the City Council has previously approved. For example, the Coral Avenue project and the Comer Tract on South Bay and Quintana both had Subdivision Map Act and Coastal Development Permit findings in the report to Council for their tentative map approval. The project has been noticed for the approval of the Coastal Development Permit as well as the Conditional Use Permit, the vesting tentative map, so therefore the City Council should include these findings. At this time, I would like to ask Council for clarification on the permit process for this project as well. More than 5 years after the project was submitted to the City and almost the 11th hour before the Council meeting, staff has arbitrarily changed the procedure and processing for this application. The City has established the processing procedure by the approvals of the tentative tract map at the Subdivision Review Board and the tentative tract map, conditional use permit, coastal development permit at the Planning Commission, and is now trying to derail the process by backing up five years and requesting that the project take a new course of action before the City Council. Furthermore, the process was clearly defined to the Planning Commission in the staff report from the September 4, 2007 meeting. Page 4 of the report, under plan development process, it said that when a project lies within a plan development overlay, PD zone, project review elevates to the Planning Commission due to the requirement for a conditional use permit. And it goes on to say that projects over 1 acre requires a concept and plans and precise plan review. The first thing to consider is there's no such thing as a concept plan for a tentative tract map. The concept plan is for the CUP and the uses on the site. The tentative map is just that, a map that outlines the boundaries. Processing a tentative tract map without specific development in a PD overlay district is somewhat of a rare opportunity. This is mainly due to the fact that there are not many properties in Morro Bay that are large enough to subdivide with 5 or more parcels and are also in a PD overlay. The best and most recent project for comparison purposes, it was similar in nature to this project and was required to attain a concept and precise plan approvals as directed in section 17.40.030, was the city's project at 2783 Coral Avenue. This project also is within the PD overlay district. The city processed a tract map without specific development for this project in 2007. The project was submitted to the Planning Commission and the staff's recommendation to conditionally approve the mitigated negative declaration and the vesting tentative map, CUP and CDP. In August 6th of 2007, the Planning Commission staff report for the Coral Avenue project on page 3 under settings said, however, the literal interpretation of the Morro Bay Municipal Code governing the PD overlay, section 17.40.030, requires precise plan review for each of the lots. Therefore, no residences are currently proposed as a component of the requested subdivision. Later development of the proposed new lots would be required to undergo a precise plan review. The city permit process outlined for the Coral Avenue project was to obtain Planning Commission and the City Council approval for the tentative tract map, CUP, and the CDP. The city did not require that the project go to the Planning Commission, to the City Council for concept plan, and then return to the Planning Commission for precise plan approvals at the tentative map stage. As far as the 10-lot project, the Planning Commission took their final action to recommend approval of this project by a motion that read, in part, motion by Woodson, Ream, second, to approve the residential conservation subdivision with the numbers attached to this project and with the following criteria, and it goes on from there. It should be abundantly clear that the process for this project should be in here with the City Council approving the tentative tract map, coastal development permit, and the conditional use permit, with a condition under the Subdivision Map Act findings that require the individual homes return to the city for precise plan review at the times of the proposed development. We have proposed language for a drainage swale on either around the entire tract, and that drainage needs to go into the drainage swales that's engineered on the tract so that it goes into the detention basin. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. The project architect and engineer are here also with me for technical questions.
Okay. Any questions for the applicant?
Yeah.
Okay. Rick?
Kathy, is this the extent of the landowner's property, or is there additional adjacent property that's not included in this?
He's involved with he has the workforce housing project, but, right. And he's also involved with partners in this. That's the extent of his holdings. The property that actually horseshoes around the 10-lot project and the workforce project is owned by the Shepherd family. And then a part of the Shepherd family backs up to the Mino family, and the rest of it backs up to the Williams Brothers or Tri-W property.
Okay, and there were two calculations, as I recall, on the elevation that was allowed. One was 18 feet, and then one was 25 feet, but it had to do with the natural grade.
The city's definition in the zoning ordinance talks about calculating from average natural grade. And this zoning designation would allow for a 25-foot house. We're proposing a different calculation for the building height because we want the houses to follow the contour of the natural terrain. With the city's calculations or the city's definition of average natural grade, if you have a steep lot, you take the highest point and the lowest point and you average it. And then if you go 18 feet 6 inches from that point, the front of the building or the building, portion of the building closest to Highway 1 could be considerably taller than what we're proposing with our definition.
Okay, and the Lot 4 design concept that we look at here, picture, I counted like about 30 mature trees that pretty much obstruct the view from the highway. And on the last page of your plans under quantities, none of those are filled out. So that's just, is there a reason for that?
This is a preliminary landscaping plan. Normally with the condition that we would bring back a final landscape plan for review at the City Public Services Department, Planning Department, for review and approval at that point. The architect was doing his best to try to communicate to the City Council what potentially it may look like. He did draw the trees a little taller than what we would say would be acceptable in the design manual, but he can prune those off.
And you touched on CCNRs. You feel that's a more viable solution than a homeowners association?
Absolutely. We've been hearing a lot of problems. In fact, just to mention that the Cloisters, for example, they do not have a homeowners association, and that's 120 homes.
And you voiced some opposition to curb and sidewalks.
Yes. We'd like to propose a 6-foot sidewalk along Teresa Drive, but on the cul-de-sac area, we'd like to propose a 20-foot wide road and no sidewalk.
Okay. Is the builder, is he going to be making attempts to comply to LED standards on these?
Since we're not proposing any development on there, it's a little difficult to completely answer that question. What we've tried to do is, in the design manual, give you an appendix that talks about green building technologies. We talk about slow green build and LEEDs and those things. So what we envision it happening is that when a homeowner comes in to buy one of these pieces of property and they want to have a development done, that they would pull this design manual and they would look at it, and they could see the philosophy that was here and that we were encouraging the green building. And then they would contact an architect to design a home and implement the green technology. Well, I don't want to go too far in specifics in the design manual with green building technology, because if somebody, for example, was 5 years from now before they decide to build one of these homes, we don't want to limit them on something that the technology could change and it could be better. For example, plastic, let's say. You know, right now, the Planning Commission recommended putting no plastic in the design manual. Well, that's not to say in 3 or 4 years from now that there might be some technology with plastic that is the best and the greenest item that you could put on a house. If we limit it now, then we're cutting ourselves off in the future. So we'd like the Planning Commission to be able to have responsibility, because they will be coming in at that time with a building, and then the Planning Commission can pick up on these conditions.
Okay, maybe for Bruce, this question, the 20 feet for the street, is that the minimum for emergency vehicles?
Eileen, maybe you can help me out here. I think it was 24.
Yeah, let's see. Right now the 28-foot wide section is 2 10-foot travel lanes and an 8-foot parking.
But my question
to 20 feet, yeah, is just for.
I don't have page 10 on my. On the revised conditions, is that what you're talking about? Sorry.
That booklet that you gave us.
Oh, the design manual.
Yeah.
Stand by.
The seashell book.
Yeah. It's under 5.7 parking.
I got it. Page 10. I'm ready.
Under section 5.7 parking.
Yes.
You have 4 bullets under there.
Yes.
And at one place it talks about The third one down, an exterior parking area enclosed on not less than two sides by a fence with a minimum height of 5 feet. It was my impression, and let me disclose now that I met with Ms. Novak on Friday, I believe, as ex parte communication. I thought that there were to be no fences other than for the parking, fenced backyard that's behind the house.
I'm going to defer to the architect for a little bit of help with this one.
Okay.
Name's Kim Hatch with Poults & Associates. What we're trying to do with the parking area is it would still have to be within that 1,000 square feet of private yard that would have to happen in. In other words, this fence, the only place you can do a fence is within your private rear yard.
So if this refers to a parking space, the parking space would have to be behind the house?
Yes, it would.
Okay. Or they could have it out front without the fence?
Without the fence.
And does that say that?
Not specifically to that, but by virtue of the fact that when you go to the first two sections in here talking about fenced, non-fenced, it's clearly indicating that the only place on the site that can have a fence on their property is behind the home within a 1,000 square foot area.
Okay. So maybe that
we
bullet could
modify
be eliminated?
That to, or what we could do is just modify that it would be contained within the 1,000 square foot of private fenced yard.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I also have a question about the open space. I'm a little bit confused about how it's going to be used, and I'm referring back to Chapter 11 of the subdivision.
Yes.
Conservation, and on page 46, at the bottom under Section B, it talks about there can be passive recreation, active recreation, etc. I'm getting mixed pictures on how this area is going to be used. At one sense, we're talking about protecting this bird that nests on the ground and this certain plant that lives there, and that we're going to do a mitigation of one-to-one if it's within the building envelope. But wouldn't that have to be within this open space area? But if people are out there walking and playing, how are we protecting that?
Maybe I can just step back for a minute. The track map itself is creating an open space easement that's going to represent 40.2% of the project without the impervious areas. So you'll have that established to start with. Now, when each individual lot comes in, you're allowed the 3,600 square foot building footprint for the home and the garage, the 1,000 square foot for the private yard, and then the 2,000 square foot for non-fenced private open space. It would be envisioned that the balance of each individual lot that is outside of what I just described, which is comes to the open space, that the city, when the lot comes forward for precise plan and review, the city could condition that remain permanent open space. We do have it set up in the CCNRs and the design manual that we're saying you can't put things in there. We are allowing the 2,000 square foot area for the patios and things like that, but no structures. We made it very clear. But then we also said in the design manual and the CCNRs that you can't build anything in this other open space, the remaining open space. So as far as mitigation purposes goes, if when somebody comes in, because each lot is different, so you're going to need to look at each particular lot when you design your house, and you're going to ask the architect to design around as much as you can the plants or anything that there has to be protected. If you can't for some reason, then the first choice would be to do on-site mitigation on the lot itself. If that's not possible, we want to be able to use the open space area that's created by the track map also to allow for mitigation purposes.
But my question then is, because you're doing that, and on here, are we doing passive recreation in the open space then? We're talking about that you want us to approve to only do the open space as a total, that there's that 42%, and yet we're going to come in and do each lot individually later, but each lot doesn't have 42% open space.
In order for the city to approve a conservation subdivision, in your subdivision ordinance, it requires that the tract include a minimum of 40% open space.
Mm-hmm.
So with the track map that's before you tonight, it has 40.2% open space easement on the track map. Mm-hmm. what's left after the tract map, if you take that open space easement, what's left is each individual lot that we've created what we call the building envelope that's also identified on the tract map. So the other additional open space that we're discussing is within the defined building envelope area on each individual lot. So the city's going to be guaranteed that you have a minimum of the 40% open space to approve the tract map. The balance of the open spaces on each individual lots, if the city wants to, if it's not satisfied with what we've given you in the CCNRs and the design manual, when the lots come forward to the Planning Commission for precise plan review, the city at that time can request or condition that project to take the remaining open space and put that into a private open space easement. They can do it in favor of the city so that the city is recognized in the easement. But that's within the development envelope.
Mm-hmm. I hear that, but I'm hearing the 6,600 square feet because you're asking for the two private and the one fence behind. So that's 300 plus 3,600, right? So we're talking 6,600?
Yes.
Okay. When I went and did the figures on that, on this chart that's in the staff report on page 6, it lists the gross lot acreage, the common open space easement, and the private drive. And if you take all that away, all of these lots do not have 6,600 square feet. In fact, only two of them do. The rest of them are all, the next largest is 5,900, the smallest is 5,300. So I'm not sure what happens then if a person's coming in and expecting 6,600 feet, which they can use, but they don't have that here. So are they going to want to take land from the private open area?
No.
Or what happens?
And these figures are wrong, I'm sorry to say, in the staff report. If you want, I got some figures here that I brought extra copies with that I'd be happy to pass to you so that you can see. But you have to look at the overall tract, and you have to understand that the open space area on the tract map that gets recorded and final equals 40% for the minimum. Also on the tract map, we have the individual properties with the building envelopes set on the map. So there can't be any changes when the map is recorded. And what's being presented to you tonight is going to be, you know, when it comes to the time for the final map stage for approvals, what we're presenting to you tonight, when we bring the final map forward, we're going to have to be consistent. So what we're telling you is that each lot has the ability to have the space. Let me get the figures for you. So we're giving you these figures, and this is a chart that was prepared by the engineer so that you can follow, I think, a little bit easier about exactly what we're trying to tell you. For example, I'll wait till you get your paper there. It says, like, for example, parcel number one, the gross lot area for parcel number one is 30,338 square feet. The common or the open space easement is going to be 13,092 square feet, and that the private drive and Teresa Drive is going to be a little over 10,000 feet, and then there's going to be a building envelope of 6,829. So you can see at each one of these lots what the gross area of the lot is and what the size of the building envelope is and how the numbers line up at the bottom. I'm not quite certain exactly where staff got some of the figures. I think there was, you know, there was so many papers that got passed off to staff on this project over the months that it was probably an inadvertent, you know, sheet, an older sheet that got slid in from something else and then got the wrong figures. But
what this basically does, though, is cut the open space down by 20,000 acres or 20,000 square feet, excuse me.
I guess I don't know how to explain it any.
So basically we're getting the 86,000 square feet, not the 104.
Box culvert built to handle the drainage. And so that's what. So, and our position is that it's not a stream.
Okay, so I'll ask staff about that. And then the last one is you want to do in-lieu money for the low-income house instead of providing for that on-site?
Yes.
But the amount that you're offering doesn't seem like enough to provide for that.
It's within city standards. The city has a standard in the housing element. The formula that staff used in the staff report is directly out of the city's housing element. What we're asking for is the cost per square foot for the construction that staff is using is 200 square feet is not an acceptable or realistic right. construction number. But the balance of the formula is directly out of the housing element.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Ambo, can we require them to do a house rather than pay in lieu, or can they choose?
You know, I think, and I need to look into this, but I thought that the council retained the ability to set the affordability margin where you mm-hmm. wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm. I thought so.
With respect to rental and affordable and ownership too. Mm-hmm. But I need to look into that and get back to you. But I recollect that.
Is it Ms. Nygaard's? Am I pronouncing your last name correctly? Is it Nygaard?
Nygaard, yes.
Thank you, sorry. Is that a stream that we're seeing here, or is it just a drainage area?
Well, I checked the county website, and they show it as a county creek.
They do show it
That's
as a creek.
That's how it shows on their website.
Okay, thank you.
If I might add that on that particular subject about being a creek, in this particular area, this property is zoned RAPD, and there is no environmentally sensitive habitat designation associated in this area.
No, but you do have sensitive species.
But if we're looking
at sensitive habitat.
But when regulations come into place, when we're looking at sensitive habitat areas, then it goes under the designation of environmentally sensitive habitat.
Thank you. Okay. Rick, your turn. Questions? Okay. Noah?
Yeah, thank you. I'm interested to follow up on, actually, and I also did meet with the applicant on the site and walked around last weekend. And one of my questions is a bit of a discrepancy or a lack of clarification on the biological conditions. It's number one. Basically, it's talking about the surveying that will be done with the sensitive species. And in the staff report on page 9, it refers to that during the applicant process that individual lot owners will be responsible for surveying of their own lots for sensitive plant species prior to construction. And I have a concern that if we leave it as that is, that would basically be potentially up to 10 different biological surveys being done by 10 different people. And I feel like this area is a pretty focused plot of land, and there are obviously sensitive species out there. And I think it would probably be best if there was a consistent survey done that was going to be applied evenly and with recognition and awareness of each component within the species list that's there. And I just wanted to know if the applicant was willing to make that adjustment so the applicant itself, yourself, would be responsible for doing those biological surveys so that we weren't leaving it in the air for many different parties to be doing that work and therefore leaving it open to potential discrepancies in how it's applied.
There's kind of a yes and no answer to this. The first yes part of it is it's already been done. The Genesis was the first environmental or biological company that came out and did a survey, and then Genesis wasn't able to do a follow-up survey for the additional area that we needed when we did the lot line adjustment. So Althaus and Mead came out to do that. In your set of plans that you have a page 2 that shows an aerial view with the biological map on that. That is intended for that to be recorded as a part of this tentative track map and the final map when it gets recorded, and that the biological mitigation measures that is outlined by the biologists from the studies that have been done are also going to be a part of this map approval process so that the mitigation measures will be spelled out. What the condition talks about that you're asking about specifically says a pre-construction survey.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to put any kind of a further condition in there that there would be one particular biologist that would come out and do the pre-construction survey, because if there's, you know, 8 years from now and the biologist that we've got decides to retire and they're not around, then we'd have a difficulty. We've laid the groundwork for you and said this is what's going on out there, this is what the studies show. This
following construction, to look at the need for further mitigation, as stated here, as far as enhancements and restoration work, what will that process be, and how do we guarantee that that will take place in an appropriate manner? Is that our responsibility as our planning department, or who does that review?
Well, for each individual site, if a home goes on a particular site, let's say where there's some bunch grass, and then that home needs to mitigate the bunch grass that they're covering, then that homeowner will have to go to the mitigation measures that was done by the biologist and then put it in the map and said, okay, we need to mitigate this bunch grass from 1 to 1, you're going to put it on site, and then you're going to have a monitoring plan. So the individual homeowner is going to have to be responsible for the monitoring plan for the bunch grass, because they're impacting it with their individual house. If it happens to be something that the developer is doing for the tract, like when they're building the road or we're doing it in the drainage basin or something like that, if we impact it at that level, we will have to, at the tract folks will have to mitigate it and then have to provide a monitoring report. And all of the mitigation measures and the monitoring reports and all that kind of stuff get developed by the qualified biologist and sent to the planning commission, or excuse me, the planning department, for their review and approval of the plan. But the biologist is the one that develops it.
Okay. My last question at this point is, I know it's a challenging one for you, because my concern speaks to the land use practices of the eventual homeowner, and it's along the lines of kind of the green building and design hopes that I would see with there and that you've laid out, but that are proposed to be addressed later down the road as the project comes forward. My larger concern, though, that I think we might be able to address is having to do with chemical use on site, especially because there is a strong habitat component to this project, and it's definitely a sensitive area in that its location is right next to the drainage to the estuary and the Choro Creek. And so my concern, and I've seen it on other projects, is that, yes, we have these good components speaking towards guiding homeowners to certain uses, but things start to become more laissez-faire as far as the management goes, and next thing you know, you have someone using Roundup along their whole property out to the boundaries into the open space area. And I'm interested to know how we could write stronger language into this to make sure that at least the chemical fertilizers and pesticides and herbicides were clearly not allowed, and that we're moving more along the lines of responsible land management in this particular type of a habitat zone.
I think the Planning Commission was trying to address that question, because I believe it was Nancy Johnson that specifically talked about the chemicals, and they were trying to, when they were approving the project, to make sure that we didn't come up with those issues, and they were trying to include those in the landscaping conditions that are on the project. So, I mean, we can, as we move forward with the, you know, toward the final map process, there'll be some, we have to develop the CCNRs further because the city attorney has to review them, so we can, some of those type of items that we can try to put in the CCNRs and make it clear.
Carla?
Good evening. I also met with the applicant on site and have had most of my questions answered via email. Thank you. And from my other council members. So I just had one question. I know we talked a little bit about the street and the sidewalks and things out there, Kathy. And one of the things we had talked about was an alternative to the sidewalk was a pathway of some sort with another type of substance of gravel, of DG or something, and we never really went into much detail about it as an alternative safe path of travel for the people who would live there. When we were talking about that, though, we never really I thought of it when Councilwoman Wenholz talked about the common areas and things. Would that when we talked about it, would it just be along the road if that were something that were to happen with doing DG or something, so there was a safe way to travel on bikes or with strollers or things? Would it just be along the roadway as if it were a sidewalk, or would it be something that would continue through the development beyond the houses? I wasn't really sure what the initial sidewalk was. It strictly just in the cul-de-sac?
Yeah, the sidewalk that the Planning Commission approved was a 4-foot concrete sidewalk all the way around the entire cul-de-sac. And so that would be, if the council would like us to put something in, we would like to say, please don't require concrete. If anything, we should use some sort of a pervious surface like decomposed granite or something, and we could do 4 foot, and we'll surround the cul-de-sac with that. There's no intent.
Well, I don't think decomposed granite is an ADA-approved surface.
Okay. And with a new subdivision, you would have to provide that, an ADA?
No, it's a private drive, but we would still be interested in making sure it's accessible, yes.
Okay. So what about just a blacktop or something like that?
Suppose we could. We could even do pavers. Okay. I'd almost, we'd have a chance to look into it, and then if we got to the Planning Commission, we could give that.
Well, because I appreciate the idea of keeping a more natural look to it if we can, but it also has to be something that's safe.
Madam Mayor, on that very subject, I don't believe, and I got both the engineer and the architect here to maybe help me answer that a little bit better, but I don't believe we can design a sidewalk on that cul-de-sac that will be ADA accessible because the slope of the cul-de-sac does.
Oh.
So okay. We won't be accomplishing anything by putting okay. in a solid surface for
so
ADA.
So it's
going to
be used by bikes and buggies and things like that, but probably
right.
not. Even an electric wheelchair?
But it's not going to be able to meet ADA standards is what I'm okay. trying to say. So we can put something in, but it won't be able to
okay,
ever
so
meet ADA standards.
Okay. All right. Okay, you gave us a new calculation sheet. I'm asking staff, do you agree that this is accurate rather than the one that was in the staff report?
I think the applicant and I have differing definitions of what the building envelope, but essentially in concept it looks comparable. I don't think that necessarily the exact calculations are important at this
yeah,
time.
They look a little.
It's the concept.
Off,
the important thing is that the concept is that 40% of the tract would be in open space versus the development area, and those details will be fleshed out during the map stage. In the next
okay.
stage.
All right.
Just follow up to that. Could you explain, it looked from the comparison chart in the back of your staff report that the Planning Commission was more interested in a single lot as the open space rather than being circular through all the lots. Can you expound on why that was?
No, the subdivision ordinance says that the open space has to be contiguous. So what we were proposing to the Planning Commission when we went there was we created an 11th lot as the open space. So after we found out that it was problematic, the direction that we were going, we decided that we should just make 10 lots, and each property line will go to the center line of the cul-de-sac, and then we will create this open space easement in lieu of creating an 11th lot. Does that make sense?
So that was nothing that the Planning Commission saw or made a decision about?
No, it was what we were presenting to them. The concept is basically relatively the same. Rather than the Planning Commission had 11 lots, and the 11th lot was the open space. Instead, with the council, we've got 10 lots, and we still have the open space. So it's just a different way of presenting it, because we did find out, since we were not going to go with the homeowners association, that it made it more difficult because we don't have an entity to own the 11th lot, because each lot owner is going to own the entire tract or their pieces, and then we'll have this open space easement on top.
Okay. I have a bunch of questions. Okay, for Rob, do we need findings, as Kathy noted, that have not been provided for the subdivision?
I don't understand that argument at all.
Okay. previously, I guess, our subdivisions, we've had findings, and so...
But we're not there yet.
Madam Mayor, I'd be happy to answer that. The,
okay.
The comparison that's being drawn to here was an entirely different circumstance.
Okay.
That was a previously subdivided lot that was surrounded by improvements, and actually, York City Council had reviewed that proposal like four or five times, I believe.
Now, which one are we talking about?
The Cloisters subdivision.
Okay, okay.
Off San Jacinto.
Okay.
So that was, forgive the expression, as comparing apples to bowling balls. It was not even the same comparison at all.
Okay.
So in our opinion, the process should work the way it is. And we've done this concept, precise plan review, as long as we've had the PD zone. So normally this gets referred back over to the Planning Commission if you're comfortable that the subdivision is performing and you like the way it performs as a concept, then we go to the Planning Commission and they make all the findings. Your approval, though, with the adoption of the mitigated negative declaration does, for all intents and purposes, create the ability to subdivide those 10 lots.
Subdivisions.
I'm trying to remember.
The lengths are different. The number of lots are different. The topography is different. The surroundings are different. Mm-hmm. Again, I mean, it's apples and a bowling ball.
Well, no, but road width is road width. It's safety. It's parking. What was required on the others? That's all I'm asking.
Each one is different. I believe Coral was 20 feet, but we did put in sidewalk and curbs,
right,
and everything.
Right.
They're all different. The reason why the sidewalks were necessary to conform with the Cloisters development around it.
Okay.
So, I mean, again, they're all different. But, yes, you can go down to 20 feet. You certainly can if that's what you want in this area. I certainly would want Mike Pond to weigh in on that only because of the area. Again, you're backing up to tremendous open space, right, as to in Cloisters he probably didn't worry about the fire hazard as we have here.
Well, on Coral, though, there's no parking on the street allowed, correct? If it's only 20 feet, there's no parking?
I would imagine that we must have, but I don't recall that. But I would imagine that, you know. And if the applicant says she reviewed that, I tried to just look it up on the internet, and I could only find the staff report, not the actual drawings of it. So
Dylan behind you was nodding yes, that there's no parking on it.
Yeah, we wouldn't allow it. I was just wondering if we actually went down to 20 feet on that street.
Okay.
The
one by the church off Ironwood?
I don't recall what the distance was on that. Again, that was a flat parcel. The zoning on Coral was R1, and the zoning here is RA, so it's...
Well, I'm more concerned with the safety width of the street. That's what I'm looking at. Safety and parking. Do we need it or do we not? That's what I want to know. Is 20 feet okay if parking's on
street? There's two. In hillside development, we normally try to minimize it. If we're moving with terrain, because it minimizes the environmental disturbance, mm-hmm, and the compromise there is that you constrain or limit emergency access, because with narrow roads, you've got more obstacles in the way. So you try to find a balance between minimizing the environmental disturbance and cutting a new road into these. And this clearly is not, in my opinion, work. This goes straight up into the hill. It doesn't work with, mm-hmm, topography at all. So
are you arguing for a narrower road without the parking to be an issue?
Normally, when you're trying to work with the topography instead of run parallel, perpendicular into it, I'm saying... this case, we could probably increase the road, but it's not accessing a whole developable part of the subdivision where you'd get windy roads that,
right,
moved along the terrain. It's not accessing flatter portions of the site.
I'm trying to decide whether we should require parking on the road. That's what I'm looking at. 20 feet wide is 20 feet wide.
And that just comes down to your practicality of this situation and looking, right, at it and whether you want to require that. It is a steep hill. You would require anybody that's visiting to have to park at the bottom of it and walk all the way up to a lot that's a lot further than a straight road,
right,
smaller lots that were on Coral. I think the distance probably would be half of this distance, maybe. I don't know for sure, but those are the things that you have to look at on that practicality. Are you creating a subdivision where there's going to be people parking illegally because they don't want to walk up the hill? Okay. That's the issue to decide.
Kathy, do you have a comment on that?
Yes, I got a couple of important things I want to comment on. First, on the slope of the road. The road slope is 12%, which is less than the city's requirement for an engineered driveway at 15%. So the slope is not great. Secondly, the turnaround area at the top of the cul-de-sac, that diameter has not changed with our asking for the 20-foot road. The fire department okayed that turning radius when we went to the subdivision review board the first time around. We can bring out the notes, and so the fire department approved it. So the 20-foot road, what we're asking for you from you is eliminating the 8 feet, which all it is the parking. So we're not asking for really a smaller road width, because right now at 28 feet and people parking on one side, the fire department is going to have 20 feet. So if you would like to go back and look at the posters that we brought with you, you can see on one of the diagrams that the road really is not going straight up the hill. It's being graded down, and it has a gentle slope, and it's only 12%. So maybe that will help out.
Okay, then let me ask something else while you're there. Do you have this on something that we can put up there? Anybody?
Oh.
This goes back to, you know, whether we want an open space lot or not.
On lot 10 is set back to a little bit, that's about even with the building next door.
I guess I'm more concerned with lot 1.
It's about the same for both lots 1 and 10.
Because you've got the road is curving in there. And, in fact, there is a little dirt road there. Is lot 1 going to, the house in lot 1 going to be on top of that little road?
No, it'd be behind that.
It would be behind that. Okay, that answers that question. Thank you. Okay. Open space. Reviewing the square foot cost, is that staff, is that something that was something the applicant brought up about the square foot and the cost per building? Is that an issue?
Normally it's matters on what type of construction. I think Dan Doris is in the audience, but I think we're probably looking at something that's probably over $150 a square foot. These are going to be 5,000 square foot homes.
Okay.
So the cost of construction is probably going to be higher than lower.
Okay. My other thought, and this is more an idea rather than a question, with parking, is that we have perhaps consider a 24-foot road and have parking on one side of the street. It's a pretty long road, and that would at least provide some on-site parking, because we know darn well if we're relying on the garages are going to be full of stuff, and they're going to park their cars in the driveway. So that eliminates where the guests would park, in my mind. So perhaps by providing at least one lane of parking within the development, we're not going to have quite so many cars. And you're right, on Teresa Drive, that's a walk. To go back to lots 4 and 5, that's a hike. If you've got kids in the family or whatever, that there's not room to park on the street. So that's a thought.
We're still allowing for some parking within each private drive as the project's proposed,
mm-hmm.
with two parking spots per drive. Is that right?
Right. And talking about the garage things, we've got it in the design manual where the people have to park their cars in the garage. And we've got it real clear in design and through the design manual that you can't leave your car out there in the driveway. And the design manual, if the city accepts the design manual as a project condition like we've asked, then the city has control over that as well. And it will be. This is also a part of the CCNR, so it can be enforced.
Yeah, but you know that's not going to happen. I'm sorry, but in a practical world, that's not going to happen.
In a location like this, I think it's got a better chance, because it's the people that are going to be buying homes and putting them in there, they're going to be caring about what they've got there. This is not just a typical little small subdivision. So,
and then it becomes the city's responsibility to go and ticket people for parking in their driveways. That's not going to happen.
No, but the CCNRs, the way the CCNRs are set up, that the people, the homeowners that live there, can go after the homeowners.
without a homeowners association. Yes, Rob.
But without a homeowners association, you have little or no chance of doing that.
Right. Okay. All right. Where do we want to go from here? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. It is a public hearing. Anyone wishing to address this issue, please step forward. And seeing no one, we'll bring it back. Comments. Who wants to start?
I'll start. I feel I'm obliged to, since I grew up on a cul-de-sac sleeping in the middle of the road and taking naps there. And I feel like it's... I'd survived. I'm here. And I would speak to the concept here that this is a very rural area. And looking at it, I would be concerned if we kept it at the existing size as far as the road and the parking. I think what we have here is an opportunity to start to pare that down and still work with what's required by the fire department and I think too it also works better with the integrity and the vision of what this project is proposing and again it is a very I know it might not be deemed sensitive habitat area, but it's a sensitive area, and the less pervious space that we have, the less runoff potential we have, and so I'm very much in favor of this concept of reducing the street or the parking to nothing, and as well as the curb and gutter concept that would be also reduced. And I think the Teresa Drive Park is good. I do generally have some concerns about public transportation access out there, and the Homeowners Association does seem to be the best way for us to address these issues and make sure that there's continuity with whatever sort of design requirements that we have and management requirements that we have. We have had conversation about making sure that there's no silhouetting on the horizon and the view shed there, and I think we should do things that ensure that an impacted area that could be utilized as sidewalk, although I think the amount of traffic on this street too lends the street to being somewhat of a walk itself. So I'm not necessarily married to the concept of having additional sidewalk surface or something that was more walkable. I'm more inclined to more planting space and open space with it rather than compaction.
Okay. I forgot one. Let me interrupt for a moment and ask one other question, and that was there was a question about the fire setbacks, 20 feet, 30 feet. Staff, can you respond to that? What exactly is the setback on the lots that are smaller? Is it does it prevent the building envelope from being sufficient or not?
The I think you were referring to lots 9 and 10 that back up against or adjacent to the seashell communities would not require a wildland interface. Do recommend a 30-foot defensible zone on the other 1 through 8 lots.
So that means 30 feet rather than 20.
Yes. It's a common practice to provide a 30-foot minimum defensible space. And in keeping with the conservation idea of the open space, we recommend that that occurs within the building envelope.
Okay. All right. That was it for you?
Yeah, and I'm comfortable with that concept if we can work it in.
30 feet, okay. Carla?
Well, I'm going to agree and disagree with Noah here. I'm good with the road. With the applicant and with Noah's suggestions there. As far as the fire management, I'd like it to refer to the building code and fire code and leave it at that rather than the recommendations of those setbacks, because I think that each of the lots is going to be varied in size and locations, and I would just prefer that it was based on the fire and building codes and let that dictate the guidelines for that. I think it would probably be more appropriate, my feeling would be. I still have a question, and I'm a little confused, and I think Mr. Ambo had said, I didn't really get a clear answer from him or if Mr. Doris was going to answer about the fees on the in-lieu housing, the mitigation fees, about from where we went from 200 to 150 or 175, how much were we at?
I think in the code that I checked referred to the housing element, which I don't have with me. I don't recall us changing that provision in the code about increasing the affordability of a requirement on a project. So I think if you're asking, can we require more affordability of a project, I believe the council can. The question on whether on the actual cost per square foot, Dan could probably answer. I think it's.
Should we ask Dan if he can answer that?
Yes. But as it relates to affordability, I'm nearly certain that's the case, and if not, then I'll write a memo or get back to you. But I'm pretty sure that we retain that ability.
The construction cost right now, with the economy the way it is, $150 a square foot is probably easily done today. Just depends on the economy. There's prices go up, the cost of construction goes up.
And would that be any different in this area of that we're looking at for the subdivision?
I think that you'd probably be in that same general area, about $150 a square foot, because they're not digging into. If they were digging into the side of the hill, putting retaining walls and stuff, the cost would go up. But since they're working with the topography, it should be cheaper.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Homeowners Association, CCNRs, do you have a feeling on that?
I think that we certainly need the CCNRs. I'm still a little not clear on the Homeowners Association and where that's going to take us. I'm hearing kind of conflicting ideas on that. Certainly the CCNRs need to be in place. I'm just not sure. I guess without the Homeowners Association, we'll have a hard time enforcing them. So. Mm-hmm. I'll go with the majority.
Do you want to ask anything about that to get more clarification? Or?
He's already said it.
Enforcement's the main problem with CCNRs.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's an HOA or, you know, there's other agreements you can do for maintenance agreements, but I certainly would recommend that you have something unless you really don't care what happens to this area as far as resurfacing the road in 10 years. And other requirements. And I certainly still believe HOAs is the best way to handle that. Title companies might not like it, but they're not dealing with the day-to-day requirements that your city will require. And so I have not even seen the CCNRs yet. So to even pass on judgment on what they do and don't say, like the applicant was saying, they have to come through my office, and this is one of the clauses that comes through mine. Staff knows that the CCNRs or any other agreements have to be approved.
Our potential to be a good project. We still control what goes on each lot. We're really just okay in a map. I think it's important that we follow whatever formula keeps the houses lower. Regarding the decomposed granite, even if you have a 12% grade, drainage, rain, bicycles, skateboards, all this decomposes the decomposed granite, and it makes it so it's not very aesthetic looking. It's not smooth. It's not as safe as it should be. So over time, there is erosion. I would prefer no parking on the street. However, I'd like to see, and having said all that, you're still not going to get everything you want from me, because I would like to see, in addition to no parking on that street, a 28-foot road, simply because that's an area where if there's a man-made fire in that area, there's nothing to stop it. There's all it is brush area, and that's a... It's a tough area, you know, and I don't think if there is somebody parking on the street that isn't supposed to, which could happen, I don't want that to impede or be an impediment to a emergency vehicle getting there, because they're going to have to get there. So I'd like to see no parking on the street. I'd like to see a 28-foot street, and I think curb and gutter and sidewalks increases the value and gives it a cleaner look. However, I'm sensitive to putting a lot of concrete in an area like that, and if we could do the same thing by putting a blacktop surface or something like that, I could live with that. Or you have something written into your CC&Rs that makes every resident responsible for their piece of decomposed granite to keep it up to a safe standard and looking right. I don't know which is going to be the easier thing to enforce.
Homeowners or CC&Rs?
CC&Rs.
That's enough?
Yeah, both.
Well, if I could have one, I'd take CC&Rs.
Are you opposed to the Homeowners Association?
I think, from what I know about the two of them, I think we're better off with a CC&R. And a heck of a lot of trees
to soften up that look. What about the 30-foot setback or Carlos' suggestion of just follow the fire and building codes per
law? That's fine with me.
Okay. All right, Betty?
I have a few things to add to your list.
Okay.
Definitely in favor of the Homeowners Association.
All right.
I want to remind council that this road is an illegal road under our land use plan, that we do not allow roads that go straight up a hill. And if they're going to violate like that, it seems like we need something in exchange for that, because we shouldn't even be allowing that.
Wait a minute. Let's get that clarified right now. Is this an illegal road?
The road is not allowed according to the LUP because it goes straight up the grade.
Well, it's a matter of interpretation. These are general plan policies, and you can apply them as you feel they apply to each and every site. Mm-hmm. I hesitate to say they're conflicting. You've just got to try to find a balance, and this is the policies in the general plan are not code, they're not translated in the code in this context.
And I agree totally with you that they're not code, but they are our guiding light for how we do our projects. And the whole reason I think they're there is to protect our hillside. But based on what Mr. Ambo said, if they're going to allow a road that really shouldn't be, then we need to make sure that it has the least visual impact. And that's why I would not go with what Mr. Grantham says with the 28 feet. I would go with what the other end of the table said is, let's reduce the size of that road as much as possible. Let's not put in the sidewalks, because if we're going to put something that's going to make this visual scar on the road, on the hillside, then let's make it as least as possible. And certainly mitigate for the visual of that with landscaping, which I'm sure is what the people want to do. But that's where I'm coming from with my perspective on why we need to reduce the size of that road, no sidewalk.
Not decomposed granite or blacktop or anything.
You've got a road with 10 residents on it. You know, who's going to be, how many people are actually going to be walking on that road?
I agree.
And there's lots of, almost all of our streets in Morro Bay, we all live on roads without sidewalks. And so unless you're a main thoroughfare, this is not a main thoroughfare. It's a rural setting. It needs to be treated that way. So the other thing is that I think, I appreciate that staff put it in here, that there will be, and what Ms. Borchardt said about the fire is fine. I think going back to what Mr. Grantham said about lots of trees, I think we need to recognize that this is a very barren area, and we're going to be creating a new habitat here, which is going to impact the habitat that's there. And I'm wondering if because of that, and because we're going to, sounds like we can go with the Homeowners Association, if we really don't want that 11th lot to take care of that conservation easement rather than have it on the backs of houses where chemicals can be applied, where people will kind of do what they want anyways, and if it's a separate lot, then maybe it will be a little bit more protected. Or maybe they'll turn it into a play area or something else. So if we want that kind of a visual, again, on the scenic highway, I don't know. But I'm open to that discussion about an 11th lot. The last thing that I'm really opposed to is, and we haven't talked about it, is that they want an extra 3 feet beyond the 18.5 feet for chimneys and other things on the roof. I'm really opposed to that. I think that they need to stay within the 18.5-foot limit that they've given themselves. I really like that they're going to stay with the grade for the houses, as long as it does not go over the ridge line. But I am opposed to allowing extra footage for the chimney. I think that should be included in that. And I would be in favor of the 75% second story that staff has proposed.
Okay. So far, we have agreement on homeowners association agreement. That's three of us, and myself too. I agree with that. I would like the 24-foot road and parking on one side. So we've got two people going with that. Would anybody else agree with that one?
Well, park trucks park on there, then you make the road 16 feet wide. You know, that's not going to work.
Well, if you got a 20-foot road and a truck parks on it to deliver something, that's not going to work either. I mean, that's going to happen. We're going to have delivery trucks just like we do on the Embarcadero that block the whole road. That's going to happen, but it's not going to happen regularly overnight unless somebody there owns a trucking company.
Right. That's, well, or they own a truck.
Well, let me suggest that a place to go look at this is like on Siena, which is not Siena, Sierra, which is one of the cul-de-sacs up of Piney Way. There's three cul-de-sacs down there. They're almost identical to this proposal. Another one, which is larger, would be the dead end of what goes in front of the Delmar Elementary School, that cul-de-sac up there off of Ironwood, where Mr. Riddell lives.
All right, yeah.
So that cul-de-sac is, but that's a huge one as well. But he does have, some of the lots have sidewalks and some of them don't.
Right, right.
So I think that's the kind of place we're looking at, very low-key, not much traffic, probably very few trucks, if any at all. They're not allowing RVs at all or any kind of large vehicles to be on their lots. So I would assume that we wouldn't be seeing them on the street as well.
Yeah, if somebody owns a truck, they park that in their driveway. That doesn't get allowed on the street.
They're allowed to park in the street, and they don't, they're parking in the street.
Can't you include it in the CCNRs that it wouldn't be allowed or post the streets? It's a private drive.
Yeah.
It's a private street.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, too, we all agree that this is a really scenic, a sensitive area for the visual effect. And if we open it up to any parking at all, we're starting to move down the line of really establishing it as a catching eyesore, basically. And I think that because there's only 10 homes on the street and sufficient garage parking as well as the drive, Teresa Drive is an excellent place for overflow for parking. And if there is someone that's sensitive and unable to walk up that hill, if the homeowner is doing something that's obliging for more vehicular traffic and guests, they're going to figure out how to shuttle someone up, drop them off at the appropriate place, and park down the street. I think if we actually restrict all parking, it makes it much more simple and clear, and we're guaranteed that that will always be open for our fire and public safety traffic.
Just redline it, maybe? Paint the curbs all red?
Well, it doesn't sound like there's going to be, well, there will be some curb, I guess, but actually be very clear that there's no parking allowed. And it would be enforced by the homeowners association or whatever group is involved with that, and just stick to that, and it becomes standard practice, and it doesn't become a slippery slope where all of a sudden you've got parking on both sides, and it gets to the point where it's the eyesore that we all want to avoid.
Okay, well, my concern on the eyesore is that if you've got parking along Teresa Drive, that's going to be what you see from the highway. You're going to see a row of cars.
Well, but Teresa's it's below.
It's below, and
yeah, it is.
The applicant has proposed extended planting on the highway side of Teresa Drive, and it sounds like they're working with Caltrans to be able to install that.
I can buy that now.
All right,
I'll go with the 20-foot road.
Trail almost. It follows, it walks along the side of the street, and it kind of softens it a little bit. It doesn't have to have heavy bends in it, but it sounds like Mr. Embo would like to chime in here.
I was just going to point out, we're getting really into the precise point of view,
if
you're just comfortable with the cuts,
not looking to dictate.
But Mr. Ambo, if we're approving her booklet, don't we need to have these things in it? Because this is isn't this a vesting map we're approving tonight? And that means that's it. We're done.
Well, you're approving the concept under the zoning ordinance, but the mapping itself will be completed for the precise plan review with the map. So, in the sense that. You can't, let's put it this way, you can't embrace the concept and be opposed to the subdivision. I think you have a technical difficulty there. So if the subdivision embraces the concept, then you've got something to work with. Now the mapping will be completed when it goes to the Planning Commission, and that's precise plan review. And I think some of the bigger issues you're getting at is the setbacks and whether or not the sidewalks on one side or the other. I think that's a good information to forward on with direction to the Planning Commission. And then what form of ownership. But I, other than that, I think we're getting into a lot of the precise plan
details. I would just request that the walkway was a pervious surface.
Okay. So we're saying, yes, we want a 20-foot road. Yes, we want some kind of a walkway, hopefully not. So hopefully something pervious. We do want a homeowners association. We do want the individual lots to observe the fire and building codes per lot rather than a 30-foot automatic setback. Betty had a suggestion about going over 18 feet with chimneys, etc. Does anyone else agree with that?
No, I was opposed to that, and they'd asked for it.
I know.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't say that correctly, that she didn't want to do that. Does anyone else agree that that should not be allowed?
Yeah, I think, you know, satellite dishes and things.
Silhouette. And, you know, wouldn't be too aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, but we're not. See, so if they're going to grade, or not grade in, but set in and stay at the 18.6, you're not giving them much leeway for a fireplace. I mean,
that's true.
On the scenic highway, my real desire would be that they all be one story. I think they should be like the beach track. You're in a scenic area. You want people to be able to look over the house and not be looking at the house, but at the view beyond. And so our view here is the hillside. But since we're not going to go with just the one story, I didn't even bring it up because I'm sure that wouldn't be very popular. But as long as we can protect that range, that silhouetting, that's the most important to me. Now, the chimney and stuff, I think, is like Mr. Grantham, becomes kind of a little bit of an eyesore. And they can, you know, they've got 18 and a half feet. They've got 3,500 square feet on one floor. I mean, if you allow, you know, and we haven't talked about it, we're going to go with the 75. I mean, these could end up being 7,000 square foot houses. That's huge.
I don't think that's true. I think they were smaller than that. My concern with that is even in the cloisters, we allow chimneys and things like that, that vents, stuff like that, that can exceed the height.
But it's not attractive. It's not attractive.
They can go to 25 feet if they want to. You know,
no, only certain places in the cloisters can do that. You know, again, it's that visual thing. We're on a visual scenic highway,
right.
One story.
All right. I'm opposed to
the other two.
I'm opposed to the restriction of that.
Yeah, we're not talking about the side. I'm opposed to satellite dishes and things up there, too, but we're talking about 3 feet of a chimney is all
right.
We're talking about. That's all we're talking about.
Chimneys
not,
and
not necessarily.
Chimneys and vents.
Look
chimneys
in your code
and vents.
See.
Vents. You know, like over your stove.
Because if we're approving this design manual, we need to make sure it's the way that we want it.
We could say no satellite dishes.
Can we get clarification?
So it says vents, skylights, enclosures, chimneys, and other architectural features shall not exceed more than 3 feet above the 18 and a half
architectural features. That is not a satellite dish.
Okay.
Okay.
Architectural features. I'm fine with that.
Okay. We agreed on that? That those are okay? All right, so we got consensus on that. What else? 11th lot. Did anybody else want that instead of an in-lieu?
It's not instead of the in-lieu housing.
Oh,
that was in place of having the open space around the houses.
All right. Did anybody want 11th lot instead of the open space going all around the property? Only Betty. Okay.
Well, my concern is that open space swath will become managed by a homeowner who's really utilizing a lot of chemicals, and I would ask that we put something in this that really has a strong element to actually not allow the use of those chemicals, and other land management practices would be in place, such as is cited,
okay.
The mowing and so on during the...
Mayor, I have one other concern.
Okay.
And that is, it goes back to what's happened at Quintana in Maine, what's happened with the Cameron iron building thing standing on Quintana, that we have these developments come in, they start, and then they don't finish. The Kosh project's another one.
Okay.
I don't want to see this hillside graded for a road, and then it sits there, and then there's nothing going on around it. So... I don't know what to do about that, though. I don't know if we can say, you know, you can't start building your road until 50% of your lots are sold, or if that's taking of property. I don't know, but my concern is that we don't end up with another half-built project, and I don't know what to do about that.
And I think that speaks to the minimum that once the road is in place, that the landscaping is guaranteed to also be in place as part of the project requirements, because that's what will soften the road until the other components of the development go into place.
Well, Madam Mayor, I think I'm not sure the formal landscaping will be, but some of the habitat restoration, I believe that is something we may want to consider putting in.
I agree.
You really could wind up with a road and not have any of the habitat restoration, kind of like what we did along the Harper Walk. All of that beyond the fence is habitat restoration. Mm-hmm. So that was a concern before.
Ron?
Well, you're not the only council and city that's wrestling with that idea. I mean, Johnson Avenue in San Luis Obispo has the cul-de-sac that goes up the hill with the lots that no one is buying right now. So, I mean, in the economy, that can happen. There's foreclosures. There's many cities that are looking on ways to, you know, deal with foreclosed property even that are empty. So it's not something that doesn't happen, but we don't know the answer to that from a staff on how you can prevent that on private property. But you can sequence certainly certain items to make sure the landscape gets done or the public improvements or other things. But to guarantee that once you start, you're going to finish, mm-hmm. I'm not sure we have that ability. Even if you said 50% of the lots had to be finished, doesn't mean you're actually going to get them done.
Mm-hmm. So how do we sequence it then?
I think just more with the landscaping. I think the requirements for that can be done.
Has to be done first?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
it has to be done on the individual homes even once they're even done for that. So you can have the landscaping for the screening of the whole project, but also on the individual can be so many months after. I know that was in a lot of the developments in San Luis had to be done within a certain time frame.
Could we also do that with the in-lieu house? Can we require them to do a house somewhere else in town, and can we have that done kind of like we did with the
yes.
original Comer project that
yes.
he had to have those finished?
Yes.
Okay, I'd like that conditioned in there.
Had to have them finished before.
They're putting into an in-lieu, though, so I'm not sure it's the same. If it's in-lieu, then we're accepting
yeah.
that money, and we don't know what the project is, as opposed to the Comer was he agreed to provide them, so we said then you need to provide them before you.
And does he have that choice? Can we ask for the house instead of the money?
I believe.
Well, we should decide that here. When is that requirement going to be triggered? So.
Yeah. Well, we've said in the past that we want our public improvements. We've learned from the past that we want our public improvements done first.
Right.
And because we never know if we're going to get them.
Right. But they're looking at in lieu rather than a building.
Mm-hmm. Well, do we want to require them to build it rather than take the money?
How does the council feel?
Money.
I'm money. How's your
money? You'll be less likely to get the house.
Yeah, but you got the money.
Yeah.
Money?
I'm comfortable with that.
Okay. We're going for the money.
And then here's an off-the-wall thing. Is there some way to make the road not black but brown or dirt-colored?
I have no idea.
I'm sorry. Sorry.
Paint?
Is there some way to make the road not white concrete or black asphalt? Is there some way to make it more of a
well, yeah,
color?
You could have all kinds of pavement treatments. Yes.
Can you? Okay. It's not green out there.
You can stain, you can score, you can pave, you can do all kinds of different things to pavement. So.
Okay.
Not
tonight.
Well, I'll throw that out there to the Planning Commission.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going for the in-lieu money and sequenced habitat restoration on construction, right? Okay, we
yes,
all agree on
and
that?
Yeah.
Madam Mayor, if I could ask for a clarification on the conceptual use of the open space, I just want to get clear direction on what the open space use is intended to be. Is it for conservation of natural vegetation, or are we allowing some other use in that area?
Well, it seems to me there's a bit of a conflict. If you're saying that they have to mow 30 feet, that's certainly not
first designation Eileen put out was that it would for somehow prohibit the landscape to be installed as it's proposed currently as far as the restoration and mitigation plantings, which those plants seem to fall into the category.
Mitigation planting is not considered cultivated landscape.
Okay, great. So I think we should, I'm really strongly supporting the first concept there, the tandem.
That is conservation use. Okay. Do we have consensus on that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes? I got three of us.
You have to go with what's in the, I mean, if you look at it in the subdivision ordinance, that says the reason why you're even doing this.
Right,
you know,
conservation.
And then on here it gives you all the requirements.
Right.
And that is one of the first requirements.
Okay. All right, so the conservation is the designated use. All right, anything else? Applicant have any questions on what we've done? I know you may not be happy with it, but have you got any questions on things we haven't responded to?
Kim's going to join in here with me, too. I think that there's a misunderstanding about a couple of different things and the way that maybe you're interpreting it and the way that we're interpreting it.
Like what?
In the defensible area, if it's within the building envelope and we have to provide an extra 30 feet within the building envelope from the rear, you have just made the property buildable area 40 feet deep.
And what we have said is that it just has to meet the fire codes,
okay,
and it will be a lot-by-lot decision.
Right. I just wanted to make it clear that there's been a lot of dialogue about the defensible area, and there is actually a provision in the code that says that if there is a reason that we can't meet the 30 or 100 feet, that we can provide mitigations on the building by providing fire protection elements to the buildings. So what we're talking about here tonight is really things that happen during the building code requirements.
Right.
We have understanding that when we've laid out this track, we understand what the parameters of that would be. We just want to make it clear that there's guidelines.
That's what we're
that are
saying. We're
set
saying
up.
Each individual project as it comes forward is going to have to meet the fire codes for that lot.
Okay, and I guess the only thing else I really need some clarification on is this last item on the open space. We have several different open space categories, if you want to call it that. We have a private fenced yard of 1,000 square feet. We have 2,000 square feet of private unfenced open space area. We will have the remaining portion of the lot within the building envelope once it's developed. Then we have the tract open space. So I'm not clear when you talk about being natural for the open space. Are you talking about for all of those things that I just mentioned? Or
everything
are you just talking
except
about
the fenced, it seems to me, that we're talking about, right? The fenced is landscape. The rest is open space. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, I thought the personal space was up to their discretion. Is that not true?
Outside the fenced?
No, well,
just the fenced.
Well, you've got the house, and the fence is only in the back, and then they've got this area down front.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that that was their personal discretion.
Okay.
But that there's land in between the personal discretions that's natural open space.
So there's 3,000 square feet of personal landscaping.
If that's what we want.
Okay.
Well,
is that what all of us had
I
in
think
mind?
Actually the fenced space was that open personal choice. Landscaping
where
and
the
everything
has to go.
And then everything out of that was to fall into the natural landscape.
I'm good with that.
And that's what's
proposed, what we're asking for is beyond the personal space that you're just talking about for the 1,000 square feet is allowing each homeowner to have 2,000 square feet of unfenced private area that decks and patios and low structures like that are also allowed within the building envelope, but it has to be adjacent to the house, an integral design part of the house. There is still going to be some additional area outside of the footprint for the house, the 2,000 square feet, and then 1,000 square foot for the private yard that will become open space, but not a part of the tract open space. So if you're okay with the tract open space.
This is the one you're talking about, right?
Right.
Okay.
So
everybody got that?
So we're talking about the tract open space being the natural, and then the remaining area outside the footprint, and then the two additional areas, the 1,000 and 2,000 okay. square foot being natural. I'm okay, but the problem that I have is what we've asked for is the 2,000 square feet allow for decks. Now, okay. in the city subdivision ordinance, it does allow for walkways and such in open space areas. So to be consistent with your subdivision ordinance, then I would say that in this 2,000 square foot space, we should be allowed to put the decks in the... What you're asking for is whether it may not be an HOA, but it is something else, and we have to prove to the city attorney that we can accomplish what you want so that we change that condition.
Right. That's what we're saying, yes? Yes. Okay. All right. So now we need to adopt the negative declaration. And what else does our motion have to cover here after all these discussions?
You could read you could even read the title of the subject for its adoption and consideration of the concept plan.
Okay.
And
with
recommend
the specific additions and things we've discussed.
Yes, I think right? we've got that. Okay. Well.
All right. Bridget's not happy with that. Okay. All right. I've got the consensus items that we have here. All right. So we need to make those very clear. Okay. Well, we'll repeat them now for you. Okay. So I'm going to try the motion then. Right. I'm going to recommend that we adopt the mitigated negative declaration and consider the concept plan for vesting tentative subdivision map SOO-062. Conditional use permit UPO 138, coastal development permit CPO 207, with the following items specified: that there will be a homeowners association or equivalent body, that there will be a 20-foot wide road, and I'm forgetting, did we say yes there's going to be a walkway? How many said walkway? Yes, and there will be a pervious walkway. That the individual lots will observe the fire and building codes to determine setbacks. That the chimneys and other architectural items can exceed the 18 and a half feet, but not satellite dishes. Okay, as I think it's as is in the document, but no satellite dishes. That the second story will be 75% of the first story. That the that the in lieu amount will be $150 a square foot. And that building will have sequenced habitat restoration. Anything I missed? Do I hear a second?
Do we need to be specific about...
Second it
you need a second.
Second.
Okay, second it.
For discussion.
Now discuss, yes.
Do we need to be specific about parking along Teresa Drive being acceptable to
I don't think
to
so.
Us?
We're not saying there's parking on the road. I don't know if we have to...
I think it's a given that there's parking on Teresa, because it currently is.
Right. And then the landscaping on the highway side of Teresa is also part of this discussion and will be included.
It's already in there.
Okay.
Included in the plan, design plan, and staff plan.
Do we miss anything?
It's right there on your...
What about, do we need to be more specific about strengthening the use of chemicals on the native landscape component?
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that come back in the landscape plan?
Yeah, I would think so.
For a planning commission?
Yes, we can do that during the precise plan.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. Thank you. That was a challenge. Thank you. Let's take a brief break and then we'll complete our agenda.
I see that your form is outstanding.
Okay, we're back, and we're on item C1, which is a review of a site generator project for Dial-A-Ride City Hall and the Public Services Department offices. And Dylan, this one's yours.
I'll try to be brief. Basically, what we did in here is we tried to give you guys the background as detailed as we could. We pieced the information back together and gave you just basically the history of the project. What we're here for tonight is to present it to you for discussion, have you guys kick it around, decide what you want to do with this project, and provide some direction to us. So that's really what we're here for, is for council discussion. Any questions you might have, feel free to ask. But really, we're looking for clear and direction on which way you want to head with this.
Madam Mayor?
In the last couple of days, including Dial-A-Ride. So I understand that there are problems right now when we do have power outages, and I understand the previous council's attempt to address those challenges. I think we have an extremely different situation right now as far as our budget and also the potential developments down the road as far as funding opportunities for alternative energy sources. Something that's kind of come up to me as I've gone through this and thought about the ability for us to realize the goal of getting better backup systems for these three buildings. And I really think at this point, our goal should be not to fund this project, but to utilize, if possible, the remaining grant funds. I think that's about $2,300 to do a more comprehensive energy audit, working with PG&E if possible, and if that's something that we haven't done, and then to take steps from that audit that PG&E could help us with to increase our efficiency of energy use within the buildings, and also be prepared as we see potential funding sources develop or opportunities for alternative energy systems to be utilized, that we incorporate those. But for the short term, I think we'd be doing really good to kind of do an energy audit, energy diet, and really just kind of bolster our efficiencies within those buildings. With my conversations with Dial-A-Ride, it's really obvious that the phone system is really the big key to them. And obviously our phone system is electrical, so that's a challenge. The thought that was talked about earlier was to do at least, at the very minimum, a backup battery-operated CB radio system that wouldn't really allow them the phone systems, which is really essential, but would be at least a line of communication so they could talk with their drivers. They wouldn't be able to receive phone calls for service, but at the very least they could maintain contact with the drivers that are out on a beat. So that's my thoughts at this point. I really do think an energy audit would be a good place to go, and that I think it's a valuable and noble goal, and I think there will be opportunities for us to achieve that in alternative ways as we move into the future.
One question on something you said. Don't we lose the grant funding if we don't use it for this project?
Yeah, I would wager a guess that if we try to adapt the purpose of the grant funding, it was specifically for the Dial-A-Ride, which was transit funds used to provide a transit service. And so if we move outside of that realm, we'll lose the grant funding. However, we have expended most of those grant funds, so there's not a ton that's on the table there.
I think it was $2,300 or something.
That's approximately correct.
Can they ask for it back because we didn't complete it?
Well, the way that we would do this, if you guys end the project tonight, what we would do is we would present a final billing to the granting agency, and then we would basically request that in the future they would consider funding the project completely out of grant funds. And so we would leave it basically open into perpetuity. For them to grant at some point down the road if they felt the need to. So I don't think that we jeopardize our standing with our grant funding. I don't think we jeopardize our long-term standing with SLOCOG on this project. They know that they didn't give us enough to do it, and so they kind of threw some money at us to get the design done. We're pretty much there with the design done, and so I think that they've probably gotten the value for their money that they were looking for.
Is this battery backup something that those funds could be used for? It wouldn't be enough for that either.
I don't think there'd be enough funds there to actually purchase anything capital-wise.
Okay. All right, Carla?
Well, I'm in agreement with Noah here. I think that the $22,000 would not have gotten us very far, and taking money from our general fund is just not something that's in our best interest right now. And with the amount that Mr. Wade has given us now is extremely higher, about $50,000 more than what it originally was going to be funded at a year ago. I'd be more interested in looking at possibly some sort of rollover phone system or something that the Dial-A-Ride could roll over to the police or some other way of getting those calls through. I know that once the fire department is done, the generator there will be available, that they have the extra generator. I thought we had some portable generators down at the city yard, don't we, Mr. Wade?
Correct. We have 5 portable generators. 3 of those are for the powering of the lift stations. 2 of those are for the water department.
But they're available in an emergency if they're not already committed?
They would be, but if we were in extended power outage, it's safe to assume that they would be fulfilling their purposes in the other departments. Generally, there are several rental agencies in the county that have one or more generators available.
Thank you.
If I may give an example of that, because I also work with San Simeon Community Service District, and they went about 8 years without a generator for their wastewater treatment plant, and they relied on rental companies or the Hearst would provide them. And that provided, because they had outages, and they always came through either the rental agencies or Hearst. And then they did have a situation, I think it was 2007, when they weren't able to get one from the rental. Hearst were all busy. And that's what prompted them at that point in time to obtain their generator finally. But you certainly can usually rely on the rental. It just kind of depends on what the circumstances are and how bad it is and how quick you can get there and get one, because they usually, first person that wants one, gets it.
And what services you're talking about, too.
Yeah, what a treatment plant was much
right,
more.
Right. This is for our public service department office in Dial-A-Ride, so I wouldn't be quite as concerned. Thank you.
Okay, Betty?
How much does a portable generator cost?
To
go for the 35 watts.
35 watt, my guess is you're in the neighborhood of 20,000 ballpark.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not in favor of the big project. Only wanted to service the Dial-A-Ride building. I still think that's necessary, and I think that we could do that. I think that I could have bought the portable for $20,000 with the grant, and now it's gone. So I think the Dial-A-Ride reads that because we need to service our people, so I'm willing to do that guy separately with the $20,000 that we could take out of general funds if we're not going to be expending $90,000.
Is that a workable plan to get a portable and put it for emergencies?
$20,000 wouldn't get you Dial-A-Ride covered. That would purchase the generator.
Just for phones.
And then you would need to make some electrical modifications to the facility. I wouldn't hazard a guess on what those was. They can range extensively depending on how complex you want to get. But most basically, you're probably talking about $3,000 to $5,000 additional on top of the generator costs, I would say, at a minimum.
What, if I can ask, what do you think about the concept of a focused energy audit working with PG&E?
I don't have any problem with that. I would probably – Joe's not here to defend himself, so I feel a little bad saying this, but – I think that would probably fit better in the facilities division. The facilities guys are going to be more familiar with the buildings than the capital projects people would be. But if you want us to do it, we'll do it. I mean, either way, that's certainly available.
Well, I would suggest that we wait to make a major decision about our energy supply until we get a little better look at the after the results of this energy audit. We may find that there's more savings and the required energy needs are less, and then either the generator or an alternative system might become more feasible to us. So my suggestion is that we start with the energy audit as the focus and then move from there, especially since we're mostly out of the winter months, which is when most power outages seem to occur.
Is that something that PG&E will do at no cost?
that's something we need to look into, but I think the potential is there, and it's definitely a focus of the state at this point to reduce energy
needs. I was just asking.
Needs.
I wasn't being negative about it, but
oh, no, it's
if
a good
it was
question.
Something that they would do as service or if they were going to charge for it.
Yeah.
Okay, Rick.
Well, this is awkward because I think I'm the only one that's wanting to go ahead and go forward with this. You know, wind, solar, or gas, I really don't care. I just want the most reliable generator possible. When something happens, it's not going to take much of an earthquake to close Highway 1, or it's not going to take much of an earthquake to crack the aqueduct, or you know, even our own fire chief says when something happens, you're going to be on your own here for 24 to 72 hours, and I totally believe that. Large metropolitan areas are going to get most of the attention. We're not going to be able to get on a phone and get a generator delivered and rented. That's just not in the cards. So. You know, we're going to have something reliable, something in place, and it's a public safety investment. So I am for continuing. We made this decision with our eyes wide open months ago, and I really haven't changed the way I feel about it.
Well, we made the decision when it was going to be $95,000, and now it's $138,000 plus $18,000, which is a little scary to me. I agree. Our budget situation has only gotten worse.
Firm that could offer a proposal at the very least, because I'm sure there would be one that would be interested in to give them the crack at it, so we had some options to choose from, look at. Because speaking to Mr. Grantham's comments, I think ultimately, those sorts of power sources are the most self-sufficient for us, especially with the battery backup. And in the long term, that's going to give us the best option for stability here locally because it's less reliant on fuel and other needs. So really, I think that's if self-sufficiency is our goal, and I think it should be, the alternative power is getting us there.
Well, I have no problem with investigating that. It sounds like that it's not quite ready to do this job yet with the alternative power. It seems like it hasn't got enough oomph yet. So certainly that can change, and if something else comes along tomorrow that's Chris shaking, we can go for it. But,
yeah, and
but I think we should pursue something to resolve the issue that doesn't impact our budget to the extent that this would.
And that's where the energy audit is really helpful, too, because it'll get us that picture.
Yeah. Okay, so is that enough direction? Okay. We will move on then to item D1, which is a letter from Dave Gill representing the Sea Scouts requesting a fee waiver for the vessel St. Joseph. And let's see, this was... Oh, Susan, you're going to be handling... Oh, Rob's going to be handling this in Rick's place.
Yes, this is a request by the Sea Scouts to request a fee waiver for their vessel St. Joseph's. You heard during public comment... I believe his name was Mr. Gill. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dave Gill. And his project has been they've taken over a vessel in the St. Joseph, which we had many issues with, was considered a derelict vessel, and we were going to have to tow it out and destroy it. And he's taken it over and is in the process of cleaning it up. He's requested a fee waiver, and so we've brought that forward to you. Staff supports the fee waiver, but only for a period of time. We'd like to put a drop dead date on it, and so that you know it at least gets them to get the project done and get the removal of the boat from the harbor, which would be a win-win situation.
Okay. Questions?
Just one question.
Yes.
Mr. Schultz, when they take the boat away, it's not coming back, is it? Once they take it to Stockton?
No.
Okay.
That's and not actually not Stockton. I mean, it's going to go by water. It's going to go up to the harbor up north.
Okay.
So
that was just in our staff report. So
yeah.
Or his letter, maybe. Excuse me.
Rick.
Is staff also recommending forgiving of the balance in addition to future rental? The current balance.
$617.
Under fiscal impact on the first page?
Yes.
questions over here? Comments? Rick?
Make a motion.
Well, you know... It's one of those deals that if we don't do anything, we're going to be stuck with the boat. And we're going to probably end up paying more than we would if we were to forgive this debt that's due and giving them, say, I don't know, what do you think is reasonable here, 3 months or 6 months at the most?
Three months was the max that Rick was recommending.
I recall his letter saying that they were going to do it by June, but I think his public comment was August, so he's already slipped a month or two on that. But being realistic, maybe we say through the end of the summer, you know, the end of August, and at that point we can bring it back to you if there needs to be any update.
Rick, when he left, said 3 months max would be all that he would want to consider from the harbor department.
It says in the letter June or July. In here.
Yeah.
In the staff report.
May, June, July, right.
Yeah.
And that'll be a total of $1,067, including their back balance.
Well, it says $1,900. Approximately, the total loss will be approximately $1,900.
It's going to be more than
and
that.
And I'd support that. I mean, in 3 months, we can also bring it back for a further waiver if, in fact, they're very close to having the project done and it at least kind of pushes him to keep the project moving. But we've been very happy with the project and the moving forward, and they are doing
good work
to the boat and getting it cleaned up.
Okay, it's about $2,000 all told if they go for 3 months and we forgive the balance.
I'll make the motion that we forgive the balance and the next 4 months, and that hope that they'll be gone by then.
I'd second that.
They'll get us to the end of August.
I wouldn't want to extend it beyond what the harbor director recommended, which was 3 months.
We're his boss. So,
pardon?
We're his boss.
I know. But I feel... All right, so...
I mean, if you want to send the message that's strong, then and no further waivers after that time frame.
Okay.
You know,
good
that's
idea.
The message to state.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. All right. Item D2. Reduced fee incentive for green building and low-impact development. Mr. Ambo.
Thank you, Madam Mayor and Council. You last directed the staff to bring this to you to consider offering green building incentives in the concept of reduced building fees. We've carefully considered this. Behind me, I've got Christine Rogers, who is a lead leadership and environmental design accredited professional, and Dan Doris. The three of us worked together on this to look at what we thought would be the best incentive to get started off the bat with a program like this. And so our recommendations really are fourfold. So the first recommendation is to offer a reduced a reimbursement of the building and plan check fees for $3,000 upon successful completion of LEED certification. Then a reduced incentive of $2,000 for something that's not as rigorous, which is Greenpoint rated. And Christine can jump in here at any time if you need some more background on that. And then a 40% permit fee reimbursement upon completion of existing buildings, multifamily, commercial, and certain residential would be a 40% fee alternative. And lastly is a recommendation to come back to you and get the mechanics of this worked out, memorialize it in a resolution. So we just wanted to have this discussion with you, see if that's workable. And if it is, then we can come back and not codify it, but we can elaborate a little bit, articulate how this thing's going to work, a little bit more detail and predictability. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them. I've got Christine and Dan here. If you have any questions
very
on how this,
waiting.
How this works, and they're very good resources. They both sit on Greenville Council, and so we've carefully considered this recommendation. I think this is a good starting point. Before I forget, the actual direction of record was to look at low-impact development as an incentive, and in our recently approved stormwater management plan is far more rigorous than any kind of incentive that we could offer, where it's a minimum requirement, as are many of these other green building standards that are coincidentally minimum requirements. And in comparison to other communities, we're finding that the people that are offering these incentives are larger jurisdictions and usually have more financial resources. And actually the trend in this county has actually been to charge a fee. So we'd be going in a pretty proactive direction here. If you have any questions, we're available to answer them.
Okay. Questions, anyone? Listen.
I don't have a question, but I'd really like to compliment on the staff report. I thought it was very thorough and very clear, and I appreciate all four of the recommendations.
Okay, Rick,
I think it's a good start. I think it'll be an incentive for folks to get started, and I'm all for it.
How about this, Noah? I know, Noah, you don't like it at all.
A couple of quick questions. One, just to confirm, we had a conversation earlier, Mr. Ambo and I, about the mention in here about the need for a 5-year strategic plan in relation to green incentives to help give us a map about where we're going so it's a little clearer. And I'm in favor of that, and I just wanted to ask the question to the council if that's something that they're interested in. And I'd plan on putting that on a future agenda item so we can be clear about that, our support of that concept with mm-hmm. staff.
Is that something that's mentioned in here? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah. It's part of the strategic.
But it's not an action item.
It's not an action item.
But I did want to bring that up. We could certainly talk about that, can't we?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's part of your analysis. Yeah. You may recall, and Council Members Funkler and I talked about this, that at our joint meeting with the Planning Commission, we had also indicated we were researching Assembly Bill 811, which mm-hmm. is a solar financing district, and that was something we were working on. And when we got to deal with all of these initiatives, it wasn't as though we were looking for more things to do, but we just thought it'd be easier to approach them in a more systematic framework.
Wanted to add that now, that we wanted to proceed with a 5-year plan, you could certainly do that. We don't have to make it a separate agenda item.
Okay, that sounds good to me, if it's okay with the rest of the council.
Not really. I'm not interested. I just feel like we just talked about this 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm.
To the community and get some positive coverage.
I think we'd be happy to do that.
Great. And as another just informational item, I would suggest that you contact Slow Green Build, because they have received some grant funding recently to work on a marketing campaign for these very focused sort of programs that are really exciting to the community. So that'd be part of my suggestion, is that you consider contacting Slow Green Build so that they're folded in and they can help with the promotions.
Actually, yes, I met her at your presentation here for the Green Building, and we have a meeting set up with the new media person and Jessica Steele, who is my counterpart on Slow Green Build for the events coordination. And so we're planning on meeting next week to get together and talk about that marketing endeavor.
Okay. Carla?
Madam Mayor, I could give a plug for Christine, too. In our affordable policy, she's integrated all of those green building strategies in our affordable rehab program. So that's something else that we're doing.
Great. Thank you. Carla, your comments?
Well, this I'm reading through this, and in 3 months' time that we went from having no one doing housing programs and asking about the 200% fees on the waterfront, which we haven't gotten anything on. We got reducing fees instead of finding out about our 200% fees down there, to reducing fees for what are now mandatory requirements as we go towards a green building. And so I'm a little confused why, as Mr. Ambo had mentioned earlier, most places that are looking at increasing fees, because as stated in this statement, this is requiring so much more staff time, we're going to reduce them. I'm reading in here the discussion, municipalities offering substantial financing incentives have populations over 100,000 people, associated funding resources, and you're citing Santa Barbara, Pasadena, and King County. So they're municipalities that are 10 times larger than ours that are offering these incentives, and I'm not quite sure why, if you're talking about strategic plans and developing all this, it's going to be communities that are charging more fees for the heightened review plan, why we're going to reduce fees on these. I'm a little confused. It seems...
Well, the waterfront review fees, we were coming back, and I think the direction was come back in 6 months, and I don't know if we've had any new projects that came in. My recollection is we were going to track that process and see how we came out in terms of the expense, because we really didn't have anything to go on. I think we only looked at two or three in the past couple of years. We looked at this and looked at this as kind of a work in progress and thought, This is a recommendation in response to your direction, and this may be something that we can fine-tune to see how it's working after a few months, and if you want to be more proactive with it or more aggressive with it, or if you'd like to back down off it and follow the lead of other communities, which is part of the strategy in developing that overreaching plan, because SLOCOG and a number of other regional entities and local resources are kind of working along on the same front, and for us to be out front of it is pretty aggressive move. And one of the things we hope this plan reveals is that we can follow behind some of these folks and leverage our resources. And we also kind of looked at this as a snapshot, and we can come back to it in a few months and see if it's working, or if you want to scale back or get more aggressive with it.
Maybe we could put that into a motion and say, let's come back in 6 months and see if we've lost money or not.
Well,
or
how much progress. It seems like it's going to evolve in time as you go anyway, because you have these mandates in that are of August 2009 and 2010, and the incentives to me are built in your energies. I mean, some of your incentives obviously are built in your savings and your energy and things, and with the AB 11 and all these other things that are coming down the line, that now all of a sudden, as we're going to meet next month to do our budgets, we're giving away money. We just approved a project for this hotel, and they're asking about what they're going to get back in now in fees, yet we just gave them, I think, five or six extra rooms that they wouldn't have gotten. They got 60% building footprint instead. I consider those all incentives that they got, and now they want to know if they're going to get money back too. So I'm not real inclined to give them that also.
Go for it.
Oh, I'm sorry. And the 3% BID. Well, I don't have to stop there. They also got height reasons. Other than they're getting their $3,000 back, they're doing it because they're environmentally conscientious.
But I think that's part of the concept of this, is to open the green building and design up to not just your traditional environmentally conscious builder, but also to more of the mainstream. And I think I would agree with Mr. Ambo, this is not going to be in place for a very long time, and it will eventually sunset, because the concept is you incentivize it for the leaders, and then as it becomes more mainstream, this is cut, and it becomes just the status quo, which will be a really great thing for our community. And we do, again, have a great opportunity to get recognition for being, a modest conservative leader. And, again, I'm willing to put in here a six-month review period and take a look at it and judge it at that point. And we'll receive some value for it at that point, and if it seems like it's appropriate to continue on, then we can.
But
or if not.
You're still asking staff to do who knows how much more, twice as much work. I don't even know how much more time it's going to generate as they learn these new guidelines.
Can I address that, Carla? Actually, LEED 2009 is coming out this month. And so there's a whole new LEED system that's coming out. And then in July, there's a new building code that includes green building standards that's going to come out and will become effective in January. So what we are saying here is that you have to achieve LEED certification. You have to achieve the green rated certification, which is done by a third party. So as far as staff time,
will have the opportunity to be included in those design phases and they're, you know, learn through that process. But as far as them achieving the LEED certification, that doesn't take any staff time. That's something they do with a third-party certifier.
Then you have to review it, and then the building inspectors have to follow it along through the process, right?
That's part of the LEED certification process. They have HERS raters. They go out and verify the Title 24. The LEED certification requires commissioning, which verifies that all of those things have been done. They have to document that they've all been achieved.
Right.
And so, no, the city would not be required to complete those inspections.
And it's a nice learning curve for staff because it's going to be expected of them anyways next year. So it's a, you know, it's a nice little baby step.
Rick?
I'm in favor of adopting these resolutions, and I don't have a problem coming back in 6 months to judge the impact of it, how many people have taken advantage of it, how much staff time it's taken, what the benefits have been. But, you know, I think we're on the right track here. I think it's a good start. Why don't we go ahead and accept these and have staff come back in 6 months and tell us what the impact is?
Is that a motion?
And can I talk? I've let the conversation go. Can I talk? I think that we've got Christine is the expert on this, and I think that that's something that Morro Bay has an advantage here to be in the forefront, and I think that is a good thing. It's not going to be to our detriment. I think that ultimately it is going to be very positive for us and for our community to start thinking this way and to be a leader in that. I mean, we're a leader in a lot of things. I'd like to be a leader in something that's really positive and recognized as a growing thing. So now you can make a motion.
Okay. I'd make a motion that the City Council offer green building incentives and reimburse building plan checks and inspection fees for A, B, C, and D of D2 and direct staff to report back in 6 months the fiscal impact and the time involved, staff time involved, and I think I can leave it at that.
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion?
So what happens in 6 months?
Well, that depends on what staff reports back to us. I mean, if people are taking advantage of this and things are going along the
growth
way we want them to, if we could look at strengthening them or offering even more incentives, or if it's not working out, then we pull it back a little bit. I mean, we have to get the information before we can make a decision.
Well, isn't that what we're doing? We're giving away the money before we can make a decision. Okay.
Well, I think this is acceptable. This is something that we can do. It shows good intent on our part, shows good leadership, shows initiative and forethought.
And staff suggested that we can do this. I mean, so they feel that we can afford it. So.
So.
All right. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, 4-1 with Carla opposed. Did you want to do a separate motion about
I
your
would
binder?
Do a second motion that we direct staff to develop a concept of a 5-year strategic green planning, green initiative plan draft.
Can we get a little time to work on that?
Yeah.
Because we've got the housing element, we've got AB 811.
They have no sanitary regulations, no certifications are required, no knowledge of blood-borne pathogens such as transmission of HIV, hepatitis C, or the precaution against these things. We don't have age limits. We just don't really have anything that controls the sanitary conditions or the certifications of tattoo parlors or people that perform the service. So from what I understand, the state has measures, but the county does not, so we do not. So I'd like to take a look at that and see if the city feels it's necessary to require education on bloodborne pathogens, correct sanitary procedures with enforcement by public health.
If I can summarize health and safety provisions for tattoo parlors, would that be the topic?
Sanitary and health and safety concerns regarding tattoo parlors, okay, and the transmission of bloodborne pathogens. such as hepatitis and HIV, if you want to name a couple.
And is that a report that you could do yourself?
Well, there's more to it than that. Because so I think while we're on that discussion, we also need to talk about how many we want in town. There's also nothing that says, you know, you can have 12 tattoo parlors on Morro Bay Boulevard. So I think we need to look at the whole thing here.
I'm just remembering that you already said tattoo parlors and massage parlors and marijuana dispensaries is an issue that we're working on already. Would this be part of that or would this be separate? It seems to me the safety issue should be separate.
No, it's a regulation ordinance that we don't have on our books, and it's always been on one of my back burners, but has never been brought to the forefront until recently with this complaint and a few other issues have come up. I think the first thing to do, if there's support from two others, at least bring forward to you the regulation scheme, what's on the state law books, what's on the county books, and how we can enforce or make that regulation stronger to protect
specifically
the
for
city.
Health and safety rather than the whole issue.
It's the whole issue. It's a health and safety issue. I mean, altogether, health and safety and planning issue. I mean, I would put that all in one.
Okay, but I'm sorry. Didn't you say earlier that you were working on that with all three categories? And I'm hoping that this issue wouldn't have to wait for that complete project.
Well, it would come to the forefront. That project that's always been on the back burner because it's never been a higher priority for council would certainly come to a sooner. But I would, before I would even begin that ordinance review, I would come forward with just the issues and see where you want it to go.
Okay.
If so there's support from two others.
I would support that.
I would too. Over here? Okay. We got support on that. Thank you. Anything else? Betty, nothing? Noah, Carla? Okay. I think that's it. And Rick has our closing quote tonight.
Well, I'm in a quandary because I have two that I really like. Can I do two?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay.
We're early.
First one. Folks who don't know why America is the land of promise should be here during an election campaign. That's my first one.
You should save that for a couple years from now.
Yeah. This other one I really like. Will Rogers. We can't all be heroes because someone has to sit on the curb and clap as they go by.
Good reminder for the parade coming up. So everybody don't forget the parade. And we're adjourned. Thank you.